Sports guys, coming to you live from beautiful downtown Norwalk, Connecticut. I'm Mike DePalma alongside my co-host Danny Santarella. We got a new producer in studio. I think is I gotta help me out with the pronunciation of the last name, Diorio, Tony Diorio or something like that. We got Tony D back behind the glass.
Yeah.
We'll see what the situation is over in the Hoboken studio, whether we're joined by comedian extraordinaire Neil Lynch. Hopefully we are. He always adds a lot to the show. We got a couple folks in studio. We got a good lineup of guests here tonight. We got a, I'm going to just tease it with an internet sensation calling in at the 9 o'clock hour, mostly because I don't have her name in front of me, but you're going to know her, right? When we bring her on, it's going to be great. And then we got Mark Smith, who I'm sure you all know, is Johnny Manziel's high school football coach. He's coming on to rap about Johnny football. So a lot to get to today, Danny. You excited? You look a little disheveled. I'll be honest with you. You do not look ready for this show. There's like 16 papers open. You got just empty cups all around you.
I am completely disheveled right now.
You are just a mess. And you just keep opening up the different Rangers articles. So should we start with the Rangers?
I'd love to. I mean, do you want to talk about how much I love them? Is that what
you're
getting
to? Are you just on board with them?
I am. I'm rooting for them.
I didn't see it, but what do you guess in the city got bigger ratings last night? You think the Rangers still outdrew Subway Series? I have this feeling, and I don't know. Maybe Tony or somebody could look it up. If we could find out who got bigger ratings. You would think sports fans would be all over the Rangers. Especially because the game last night between the Mets and Yankees got a little out of hand. But I still have this gut instinct that in New York, it's still a baseball town, and even a meaningless, interleague game between two mediocre teams is going to do a bigger rating than a Game 7 elimination game for the Rangers. You think I'm wrong?
No, I think that's the biggest problem most hockey fans like myself have, is no matter what's going on in the hockey world, it's overshadowed by something. I would say it was probably overshadowed by the NFL draft. It gets overshadowed by, like you said, a meaningless series in the middle of May. Like, you know, but, it, you know, for people that are Islanders fans, Devils fans, I just have a feeling they're watching. If they're like me, they're interested now because you're going, the whole San Luis story, you know, he loses his mother. Now the team's kind of rallying around him. It's a better story to follow for me, and I don't get how sports fans aren't into it, than Tanaka pitching or Montero getting called up or whatever. To me, it's, you're going, this is a team rallying behind one guy who's a leader, who's won the cup before, but he's, by all accounts, a great dude. Everybody's behind him. They come down, come back from 3-1 down to a team that, man for man, is better than that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, explosive.
You know
all
I mean?
These guys.
The only edge they really had was Lundqvist.
Yeah. But the guy, Fleury, was phenomenal in the put him up 3-1. They had back-to-back shutouts, right? I mean, he looked all of a sudden, because I remember I texted you. I'm like, all I heard was that this goalie was horrible, and he's just, you know, throwing up shutouts.
Well, he hadn't played well, and then, you know, they call up Vokoun again, who spelled him last year in the playoffs when he wasn't hurt. He just stunk.
Uh-huh.
So they take him out. They put in Thomas Vokoun. I had said, you know, I think I said in the text to you that he's a guy who they won the cup with him playing great. Now, obviously, you have Crosby and Malkin. They have all these great guys, but they won the cup a few years ago with him playing unbelievable, putting up like a 94% save percentage. He's been on Team Canada before, so he's not like a clown.
Yeah, right, right.
He's nowhere near Lundqvist, even when Lundqvist is just good. Like, when he's not great, he's better than when he's just good.
Yeah.
But to watch them play from end to end better than Pittsburgh for three straight games was extremely impressive, because they really did. I mean, I couldn't watch the game last night, but I listened to parts of it, and everything you heard from the radio analysts was what you would confirm what you had just watched in games 5 and 6. They're just playing better, harder. They got production from four lines.
What I will tell you, they kept bringing that up during the broadcast about the fact that with the lead, even in the third period, they stuck with four lines, which I don't know that that's odd, but apparently in the hockey world that is odd to do, to keep your fourth line in crucial times in the game, the third period, but he stuck with it. They seem fresh, and they seem to be a little chippy, which I don't, in a few Rangers games, you know, like I said, I probably watch bits and pieces of maybe a dozen Ranger games, because I know you always yell at me to watch them, so I'll try to check them out from here to there, and they seemed a little bit grittier, they seemed a little bit more, like, tougher to me than they have all season long, which is weird, because when they got St. Louis, everybody was like, you know, they got a score, but they came a little softer. They had this little, maybe it is, rallying around St. Louis, I don't know, but there was a little bit more grittiness to it. What I'll say about the third period, it almost benefits me that I'm not a big hockey fan and don't know a lot about it, because when you don't know what's going on, every possession seems like it's going to be a goal. Like, they're going to score right here. Like, you're talking about sitting on the edge of your seat. You're literally sitting up on a couch at 11 o'clock at night, like, oh, my God, is this, what's going to happen here? Like, it seems, and there was, I think, 13 or 14 shots on goal He had, 13 or 14 saves in the third period alone. And, I mean, just, save and then, getting a rebound and another save. It was amazing. He caught one in underneath his armpit at one point, and they had to review it because they're like, where is the puck? It must have gone in the net.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing with the Rangers in terms of last night, they get the first goal from Boyle, who's playing on the fourth line you alluded to. He's playing with Brassard and Dorsett. And you're seeing guys like that now, the depth scorers producing for them. And the biggest concern I think most Rangers fans had coming into that series and maybe even the playoffs was, could they get the top-end front-line scoring? And for the most part, they kind of have. But to get a goal from the fourth line and as well as those three have played, and now you're getting production from your depth defenseman, your fifth and sixth defenseman, they're a team right now to really be reckoned with. They have something to play for now, like not that they didn't before, but now they're playing for Marty, and, he seems to be kind of the de facto leader now without Callahan. And the thing I'm most interested to see now is in terms of you're getting down to the nitty-gritty here when you start looking at goaltenders for the teams that are left. So you look at the Boston-Montreal series tonight with Price and Rask. You look out west with Chicago getting through with Crawford, and then Anaheim and the L.A. both have great goaltenders. What the Rangers have is a hot Lundqvist who, when he's right, might be the only goalie in the league that can compete with Rask, Price, Crawford, any of those guys, Quick out in L.A. They got the Gibson kid now playing in Anaheim. He's 20. He's playing in his first games. He's just messing around, putting up like...
Yeah, he was just playing minor league hockey like two weeks ago.
He's just saving 95% of the shots coming at
him. Yeah, just whatever, in a big spot.
Yeah, so you have a Rangers team now. And like I said, I am rooting for him. And
well, let me
it's
get
a
to
strange
that.
Place for me.
You know what's interesting to me? It's like we've talked about a million times. I will say that hockey fans are the most diehard, especially in New York. Ranger fans are like the most diehard Ranger fans, like, fans of a team, more so than the Yankees and the Mets and the Jets and Giants, whatever. I get that sense. But I also get the sense, for some odd reason, that Devils fans and Islanders fans are not here rooting against the Rangers, which is very odd to me. I get that sense from just talking to people, from looking at Facebook or Twitter. You would think with that kind of passion, you would hate the Rangers with all, it'd be like me rooting for the Patriots. So it's very, very weird. Well, am I wrong about that? Or you would think you're in the minority as an Islanders fan?
No, one of my buddies who's an over-the-top Devils fan is all in right now with the Rangers. He's committed to wanting to see them do well.
To me.
And I'll tell you the couple text messages we've had the last few days, and I think we kind of got our finger on what we think it might be, which is we both realize that our teams cannot do what the Rangers can do for the game. They can't.
Yeah.
The Islanders couldn't possibly build up this kind of momentum by making a run to the conference finals. First of all, they don't have the talent to do it. But second of all, let's say they did pull some rabbit out of their backside, and now all of a sudden they're making a run.
That's not going to take over the city.
No, not at all. And
the Devils
made the Cup Finals 2 years ago. And one of the games against L.A. got like a 3 rating.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
I mean, they were a dynasty for a little while, and they did not have had every opportunity to take over the area, and they didn't.
They've won 3 Stanley Cups since the Rangers won in 94, and no one really even talks about it. Oh, the only thing people talk about is Marty Brodeur.
Yeah. People know him, right.
Yeah, but they don't talk about how relevant the Devils have been for the better part of 20 years, But for me, it's the realization that I don't like most Rangers fans I know. I don't have a problem with really any player on the Rangers team, and I love Lundqvist. I've loved Richards and Nash for a long time. Big Marty St. Louis fan from all his days in Tampa. I think you're just realizing right now, and I know you get a kick out of this stuff, but you have the possibility now of back-to-back original six Stanley Cup Finals. And whatever you want to say, the ratings last year for the Stanley Cup Finals between Chicago and Boston were the best they've had in 20 years.
Yeah.
Okay? So you went from 79 with since 79, no original six matchups. Now you're guaranteed a matchup in the Eastern Conference, and Chicago's the only original six team out west, and they're still left.
Yeah.
And that's an awesome thing for me to look at. The potential of a Chicago-New York Stanley Cup Finals is just – it's so much cooler than anything the Islanders can do.
Yeah.
But even with Tavares and Oposo and those guys, they don't have the selling power that the New York Rangers do.
But that's what interests me so much about hockey fans, is that you guys care about the brand of hockey, like promoting the game, and you're just like flabbergasted when guys aren't into it, which – at first, I was like, "That's so bizarre," but I admire it that you guys. It's like you just love the game of hockey and you want to see the game of hockey do well. For me, it's like I could really care less what the World Series ratings do. I'm like, if people don't like baseball, then screw them. And they, you know, whatever, they're not into it or whatever. Like, you know, I'm not one of those guys that's like, we really need to bring back, like, get the youth into the game or get, you know, African-Americans back into the game. If they're not into it, they're not into it. And, got, you know, I'm into it. But I admire that in that, like, you view the playoffs and the Stanley Cup as, like, a way to bring it to the masses and get people to appreciate it. I don't want to burst your bubble. I don't care who plays. I don't think it's ever going to you know, that's not going to be something that's going to make somebody, might make a few people, not enough to move the meter enough to make hockey, you know, surpass any of these other sports.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is when you start talking about the four major sports, which everybody uses that in the vernacular to describe hockey, baseball, basketball, football, NASCAR gets way better ratings than hockey does.
Yeah.
Golf, the majors get better ratings. Tennis, the Grand Slam events get better ratings. So you're talking about a sport that might actually be sixth.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think to hockey fans, it's that great of a sport that we just want people like you to say, you know what, don't just watch the third period of a great game. I mean, get into it. It's great,
yeah.
You know. But I think the respect that we have, the nostalgia we have for those original six teams, when you look at the merger in 67, it was a group of players getting together, convincing the owners, like, we need to spread out.
Yeah.
And that's a rare thing, that players would look to bring in more players to take up more jobs. You know what I mean?
It almost
seems odd to me that you'd want to open the door. Like, you're now the 120 best players in the world, and you want to bring in four new teams. Like, why the hell would you want to do that?
Yeah, right.
But they did it. It was the Gordie Howes. It was the Maurice Richards. It was all guys that knew, Bobby Hull, we have to spread this brand if we want this league to survive. So I don't want to sound, I don't know, if it's too over the top, like a melancholy thing, but you're appreciative of those six franchises for allowing eventually in 72 the Islanders to come in.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I mean, I'd be a Rangers fan. How bad would that be?
That'd be brutal.
But now I'm sitting here rooting for them going, this could be great for the game.
You know what? It reminds me a little bit just hearing the story, and I don't know the background of the merger and all the rest, but, you know, you always hear the stories about the Mara family and the Rooney family and these successful franchises in the NFL that could have just taken their money and been like, you know what, I don't give a damn about the league. And both of those families understood the importance of growing the brand and doing all these things and talking about revenue sharing and expansion and going to do, you know what I mean, and putting the good of the sport ahead of their own pocketbooks, which in reality right now seems impossible, but the Mara family still owns the Giants. I mean, that's an admirable thing, and that's why I've always said I think the Giants are the best run organization of the nine, you know, local sports teams, and that's one of the reasons why. I mean, they just get the big picture, they get everything about it. They're just such a sound franchise, and I think that you know, what you're saying kind of feeds into that, and maybe that you know, ownership like the Maras and the Rooneys and the Houses back in the day were really what helped bridge this gap and put them where they are now.
I think the one difference is that an Islanders fan, or most that I know, Devils fans, there's that nod of appreciation. You might hate the Rangers, you might hate the Maple Leafs, or whatever one of those six teams you dislike, that's fine. But there's that nod of appreciation, like, that, you know, we appreciate you letting us in so that the league could be as big and cool as it is for us now. There's really not that in any other sport. There's not, I don't see, maybe there are, but I don't see the Jet fan tipping his cap to the Chicago Bears for, thanks for making the league really cool. Or, you know, and that's what's cool when you see the Bears and Packers get together. And I hate both of them, but there is something cool about that matchup in the middle of December at Lambeau or Soldier Field. And it's like, this is really cool because this goes all the way back to, like, like Bronco Nagurski and all those guys. That's cool, but there's never that nod really in the other sports, not even in baseball. You don't see it.
No, and it's funny you say that because it's a way to bridge the gap to annoying Yankee fans. Because it's like the Yankee fans are mad that you don't want to tip their cap. And I thought about this during the two games of the Subway Series, where now all of a sudden every Yankee fan in the Subway Series is completely meaningless.
Right.
Although 3 days ago on Facebook and Twitter, everybody was all amped up about it, how they were going to just dominate the lowly Mets, including Francesa talking about how the Mets can't hit, all the rest. Now it's meaningless because the Mets won a couple games. But I'm going to my brain. You could never just have a conversation, like a real, like we always talk about sitting at a bar talking sports, and we talk about how the nerds have ruined it with all their crazy sabermetrics. And I feel like you can't have a conversation with most Yankees. There are Yankee fans you can, because they'll always be like, well, 27 rings. Like, I can't, if I'm talking to a Raiders fan, they don't bring back champions. They don't bring, throw that up in my face. I don't want to talk about the Jets and the Raiders. Then I'm going to be like, well, we won all these titles back in the 70s. UCLA fans, I want to talk about UConn. I'm not going to run into a UCLA fan and be like, well, you ever hear of John Wooden? Like, no, but Yankee fans still want me to tip my cap to Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle. Why can't we talk about the team right now?
I'll tell you something.
They want to talk about 27, and they've only won one in the last, I mean, 15 years.
I was talking to a friend of the show, Rich from Huntington, a couple nights ago.
Oh, yeah. Familiar with Richie from Huntington.
When the Mets won the opener of this series with that phenomenal double play, due to turn. And, you know, I said to him, I'm so happy, and I don't really have a rooting interest either way. Like I've said it before on the show, I'll root for the Yankees for my dad when they're relevant or whatever, but most of the time I'd rather see the Mets be kind of the cool team. And I was saying to him that all this is proven. That was just one game, but now you see last night's win, and, you know, was it 12-7 or whatever it was? I think it's Met fans kind of had this mindset of, we're probably going to be pretty average this year. And now there's this turning point where you're reaching where you're going, you know, maybe we could be pretty good. We're right around 500. Maybe we could turn the corner here and maybe make a little run at something, even if it's July or whatever.
Syndergaard, Montero,
absolutely.
And blah, blah, blah.
And I think Yankees fans can never face the reality of, we expect to be great every year, even if it's like 10 bozos that you're putting out there, 9 bozos you're putting out there. And now they're looking at like,
oh, it's maybe, 10 because they got the stupid DH.
Maybe we're just average.
No, never.
But they'll never admit that.
Well,
so now they downplay the Mets.
We had an argument with a guy, friend of the show, Nick from Norwalk, calls in all the time, and he does a great job with his website for the Yankees.
Yep.
But when I posted something about Montero, he was like, he's going to get blasted. The Yankees are going to. And I'm like, at best, the Yankees' offense is mediocre.
Yep.
You're playing in that ballpark, and going into the series, they only had 13 more runs in 36 games than the New York Mets, who are admittedly bad. Yeah. And play in a big stadium. And you just see, you just watch the game, and you look at the home run Travis d'Arnaud had, and you're like, that shouldn't be a home run in junior Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
That should not be. I mean, it was like a lazy fly ball that scraped the back of the wall, and it's a home run. Even when he hit it, it was like a slide, it was a good pitch, and he flew out to right field, and it was a home run. And you watch that, and you're like, that's not a Major League Baseball stadium.
Yeah, I mean, I actually saw someone on my Facebook feed last night post, who had posted a couple of days ago, when Granderson, I forget what he did a couple days ago, but then he hit that homer last night. So his argument a couple days ago when Granderson got a hit was...
He hit a home run, too.
Yeah, right. Like, didn't he hit one?
Yeah, he's hitting one in each game.
Each game, right? So his argument was a couple of months ago, see, I told you. Not a couple months ago, around the beginning of the season when Granderson was really, really stinking it up. See, I told you he stinks. Then he hits the homer, or homers, and my buddy goes, he can only hit there. So what goes on, I see your point, but I'm getting at there's always going to be an excuse. No matter what happens, and that is frustrating because like you were kind of saying, you don't hear Raiders fans or Steelers fans, you don't hear Canadians fans say that up in Montreal. Like, what about Maurice Richard in 1957? It's like, it's 2014.
Exactly.
So they do have all the rings and they have all that cachet and that's great, but I just think what it comes down to, like I said, is it's now the Mets going from possible or expected mediocrity to maybe doing something in an NL East that now you see, like, Fernandez go down, the Braves have had injuries, and all these other things.
The Braves
can't score a run.
Stinks.
You look at the Phillies doing whatever the hell it is the Phillies are doing in Philadelphia, and you go, maybe this Mets team
could
get something going.
You could win that
division,
seriously, 86-87.
Right.
So I don't think the Mets will, but I do have this feeling, and we talked to Neil a few weeks ago about it, I had this feeling that they're going to be relevant in late August, September. Just be around 500 so that there's a reason to watch. And to me, that is a big deal because you looked at like what the Orioles did where they made this leap, and it started with a good end to the season and being relevant and winning against the Yankees late in the season, winning against the Red Sox. And all of a sudden, like Buck Showalter's first season, you look and you're like, he actually's turning this team around. I do think it's important that they don't just say, well, it's always going to be next year. I think you have to get these guys, LeGarces of the world, even David Wright, who is an all-star third baseman, but it's been so long since they've been good. Get them in the back into the mindset of we're going to be playing meaningful games down the stretch of the season. I think that's very important, and I think you're going to have stretches just like the Mets have been. They went on this run and they looked good, and they're 4 games over .500, and then they go and get destroyed out in Colorado, swept by the Marlins, and they look terrible. And you're going to get that back and forth, but you get a guy like Montero up, you got Syndergaard in the wings. Everybody talks about like what are they going to do with guys like Dylan G? They have too much pitching. We have to start trading it. Dylan G's on the DL right now. You could never have. Wait till that problem occurs when you have all six of these guys healthy, and then we'll talk about what we're going to do. Mejia's going to be very good at the bullpen, potentially a future closer there. I just think that they're moving in the right direction, like you said, and I just find it frustrating because you don't have the argument with any other sports fan. If I want to sit there and talk, you want to talk college football and say you're an Alabama fan, I don't think that Notre Dame fans are going to be like, screw you, remember us back in the 60s?
Well, I think the interesting thing is you hear a lot of times that baseball is better when the Yankees are good. And there is something to be said for that.
I agree with that.
You know what
100%.
I mean? 100%. But the thing I've always noticed, and maybe it's since, you know, since the White Sox won back in 05, and then you hear that in Chicago the argument was baseball is better when the White Sox are relevant. Well, baseball is better when any big market team is relevant. And if the Yankees happen to be at the top of that heap, that's the way it is. But it's the same thing for Boston. It's the same thing in Chicago, Philly, L.A., Anaheim, whatever. The argument kind of leans towards when Yankee fans say it, that baseball doesn't mean anything when the Mets are relevant. I think when the Mets and Yankees are both relevant, when that occasion occurs, it is good for the game.
Oh, yeah.
But they downplay the Mets as though they're not in a major market, and that you hear people mention they don't fill their ballpark. Well, I mean, have you seen Yankee Stadium?
Yeah.
Have you looked at the luxury seats behind the plate? They're probably all paid for,
yeah,
but nobody's there.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
I've never been to a sold-out game at the new Yankee Stadium, and I've been to more games at the new Yankee Stadium than Citi Field.
I just wish people would stop talking about it as though, because you're the little brother in the city, whether it's the Mets or the Cubs or, you know, whatever,
the Jets,
that you're somehow irrelevant.
Exactly. I get that. The Jets will never take over New York.
No.
Brooklyn will never take over New York.
No.
But, and that's fine, but they could be relevant. Like, you know, the Clippers are never going to take over L.A. But right now, they're the team. That's why I didn't think that Rex Ryan's statement about the fact that they went to two AFC championship games in a row, and in those 2 years, the Giants didn't make the playoffs. Yeah, the Jets were the more relevant team.
Right.
The way he I think, like, you know, the way he said it was too bold and all the
and
rest.
And it's Rex.
But it's Rex, and people are going to hate whatever he says. But that wasn't insane. It doesn't mean that there's ever going to be a time that the Jets take over New York. Maybe 50 years ago, but you talk to guys, you know, we were very young in the 80s, but you talk to people back in the 80s, they would say this was a Mets town, you know.
Right.
Could it ever get back? I even believe, though, they say it was a Mets town. I think that just means it was like the trendy, the transient fans that are in New York wanted to go to Met games over Yankee games. I didn't even get that again, but I think, like, you know, families living in the New York area, there's still always going to be the majority are going to be rooting for the Yankees over the Mets and the Giants over the Jets and the Knicks, you know, and the Rangers over the two other teams. It's just what it is. But to just if you're going to make that argument that it's just meaningless, then why ever talk about sports?
Well,
you're
every
conversation is going to end with we have 27 rings. Like, okay, then why do you want to even talk to me about sports?
That's
going to be the ending. It's
there's,
so stupid.
There's guys in our father's generation that were, you know, at least my dad's buddies that grew up Giants and Dodgers fans, right? And then they move, they go out west, and they'll tell you stories about in their neighborhoods here in Norwalk, like when the Mets came in 62, it was like the chic thing was there's a new team in town,
yeah,
a new rival to the Mets, the Yankees, and it was a cool thing. And then over years, the Yankees, like, which they just seem to do like a vacuum, they just swallow up everything, and there's nothing left for the Mets. Now, like I said, I'm not a fan of either team, but I look at it and go, you know, if the Mets can make a little run, that's kind of cool. It's out of nowhere, and you go, boy, that, you know,
yeah. That's
like Tampa Bay 10 years ago. Like, all of a sudden, they're out of no place, and you go, look at this team down here
irrelevant.
That nobody's looking at.
Even the Pirates last year.
It was great.
Or, like, that, when they, that you saw their fan base in that one-game playoff, was insane. Like, that moment was the moment of the baseball season. Even though the Pirates didn't go on to win anything, that moment where they're chanting, it was like, it was insane. And you saw it, like, how appreciative they were.
And you know what's going to happen? If the Mets make the run that we're, you know, proposing here that they could possibly make, then you're going to hear from Yankee fans about the fact, like, look, all of a sudden there's more people in Citi Field. Look, all the Mets fans are coming out of the woodwork. You know,
they're
going to squash you no matter what you do.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the
Yankee
machine, and that's the way it is.
We're going to get squashed. Oh, look, where were you guys? Well, why would I go watch a team that's a 90-loss team? Like,
and
you know,
no one's knocking,
to do.
No one's knocking the Yankees for all the success they've had over the years.
No one
knocks them for it, but you get tired of hearing about it at every turn. Anytime I, the little Cubs fan, open my mouth, I have to hear 1908.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like,
so why even talk about sports?
Do the Cubs matter to you, Yankees fans? All of a sudden, like, I can't say anything derogatory about the Yankees without hearing 1908.
Yeah, right. You can't even discuss it.
So at that rate, no Cubs fan should ever be in a baseball
You shouldn't even talk. Yeah.
Ever. So I'm not. I'm not going to talk anymore about anything.
All right, let's go to a break. We got a great guest coming up.
Yeah.
Mark Davis? Mark Smith?
Smith.
Mark Smith, I apologize. Coach Smith is going to be calling in shortly. Johnny Football's high school coach. I think he's going to give a lot of great insight. If you do want to call in, obviously the number to call is always 347-637-2306. Check us out at TriStateSportsGuys.com, Facebook.com/TriStateSportsGuys, or follow us on Twitter, as always. And you did a great job live-tweeting the draft. I was loving it.
Pretty good,
just
right?
Eating it up. At @TriState_Sports, eating it up. You got to take over that Twitter account because we're bringing nothing.
Wait till this Rangers series starts.
Oof, it's going to be nuts, huh?
It's going to be good.
All right, we'll be right back with the Tri-State Sports Guys.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius. Today we salute you, Mr. Fantasy Football Manager Guy.
Mr. Fantasy Football Manager Guy.
Every year you assemble your closest friends to prepare for another season in the knockdown, drag-out world of make-believe football.
4 minutes.
You were born with the one skill every manager needs to play fantasy football. Absolutely no skill playing real football.
Not so good at catching.
Imaginary catches. Imaginary touchdowns. Next up, an imaginary score with an imaginary woman.
Good imagination.
So crack open a nice cold Bud Light, O Swami of the sidelines. You may come in dead last, but you're always first with us.
Mr. Fantasy Football Manager Guy.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
We're back with the Tri-State Sports Guys. As Michael alluded to prior to the break, we're going to be receiving a call from Johnny Manziel's high school football coach, Coach Mark Smith, in a little bit here. I wanted to go into a little bit of the draft prior to talking to Coach Smith. The whole Manziel thing was kind of a situation where I looked at it and said, everybody just kind of overlooked the fact that they nabbed Justin Gilbert on most people's draft board, the number one corner, and then just happened to grab Johnny Manziel, who might be the most exciting offensive player in the draft, or at least the most newsworthy offensive player in the draft. And people were kind of poo-pooing the Browns, like they always seem to. And there they were, best corner, quarterback worth talking about, and now everybody's sitting here going, he's not the starter, he's not going to play, he's not going to do this. And that's probably the same stuff he's heard his entire life. Would you not think? I mean, that's something he's heard as maybe the little guy. He's not going to play. He's not going to be any good. And I've said some of those things on the show that I don't know how he kind of profiles as an NFL quarterback because he's not the Tom Brady or the Peyton Manning type. But then you see Russell Wilson win the Super Bowl. So at some point, do people stop knocking Johnny Manziel, or is it just a situation here, Coach, where they got to see him play and they got to see everything he could do in one mini camp?
It's tough. The only thing you could go on is literally all the experts, and I'm not talking about the Mel Kiper, I'm talking about the real experts. Bill Parcells interviewed today, and he said if he could stay healthy, he's going to be very good. Everybody's concern with Manziel is not if he can play. They all know he can play. Is can he stay healthy or not? And that's going to be the big issue.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously that's a situation where when you're not the big body, the big well-built quarterback, that's something everybody's going to talk about. They did it with Michael Vick. They're going to do it now with Russell Wilson until he sustains some kind of injury. It's the morbid way, I guess, the business works of you're not big enough. They did it about Danny Woodhead when the Jets had him. They said this kid's never going to last, and all you see him do is go to New England and be good, go to San Diego and be good. He's not that big a kid, but he plays an effective brand of football. But I think everybody was on the who's Houston going to take, and was there really any question? He's the only guy, and I argued this on the show, he's the only guy that you could explain as a bust in 2 years with the first overall pick. Mm. With the way he graded out at the combine, he is the only pick in that whole draft that you could explain in 2 years' time. And then it went from him to let's forget about Greg Robinson, let's forget about Blake Bortles for some reason going third to Jacksonville, who just signed Chad Heady to a 2-year deal, has so many holes to fill, needs weapons for him. And they did get Marquise Lee, and the kid whose name's eluding me out of Penn State in the second round to get him some weapons. But everything went from Clowney to Manziel. Mm-hmm. There was no talk about in between about the Raiders getting Mac, the Vikings taking Anthony Barr out of no place for God knows what reason. And I alluded to it a minute ago. Justin Gilbert, the highest graded corner in the draft, goes to Cleveland. So they get him and Manziel. So why do you think it was? Is it that big of a separation between talent, between Clowney, Manziel's kind of profile as this high, you know, media darling kind of kid that he is or whatever, the kid that everybody knows he might get in trouble or do whatever, that everybody just forgot about every other pick in the middle, it seemed. Like 21 picks went and everybody goes, who cares? Where's Manziel going to go?
Yeah, he was – because you just said it before, everybody knew Clowney was going one. Whether the pick was going to be traded or not, he was going number one. And then what's the next biggest thing? Johnny Manziel, not even close. It got to the point where, and I like this guy most of the time, I almost had to put it on mute. That's how annoying John Gruden was. I don't know if you watched it on ESPN.
Right.
Every pick he was saying, you got to go with Manziel, you got to go with Manziel, you got to go with Manziel. unfortunately, that's the way sports are now. It's you go with the superstar, so-called superstar.
Yeah, you know, I could see how someone could find Gruden a bit abrasive or annoying, but I do, and again, Coach, you know, I've said this to you a million times, you know a lot more about football than I do, but I respect Gruden, his opinion, because he seems like a guy, and obviously he's a Super Bowl winning coach, so he knows something. I'm not saying you're saying he doesn't, but I watch those QB camps he runs with each of those kids, whether it was McCarron or Bortles or Bridgewater or Manziel or whatever. And he did say the minute he came out of that deal with Johnny Manziel, there's no holes in this kid's game. Now, I don't know if that's just because he liked him person to person. But I got to say, if the Vikings got him instead of Teddy Bridgewater, I'd be thrilled. And that sounds odd, but if the Vikings traded back up into the draft at 22 to get Johnny Manziel instead of trading up to 32 to get Teddy Bridgewater, who I think doesn't have anywhere near the upside of Johnny Manziel does, I would be thrilled. So I didn't understand all the negativity. And then you're reading Twitter, you're following things on Facebook, and people are getting a kick out of Manziel being stuck in the green room like they did with Aaron Rodgers. And I look at that and go, whether you like him or not, this is a kid trying to live out his dream. He's being embarrassed in some kind of way on national television, and people are finding getting a kick out of that. Like what the hell is that? That we have we sunk that low as a society where we Johnny Manziel becomes a punchline just because he does some money finger stuff and he's a kind of a hot dog? Like, well, why am I supposed to be happy a 21-year-old kid is unhappy on draft day?
Because he possibly can get $40 million and never play.
There's reasons why Johnny Manziel is disliked.
I didn't say that there's not. I said, but no matter what it is, he's a 21-year-old guy. Now, if that's your brother or something like that, you're going to look at people and say they're idiots for thinking that way. I don't care how much money he's going to make. People were actually wallowing around in this anti-Johnny Manziel hate speech stuff, and I was going, really? Like, all of a sudden, we're supposed to hate him? Like, I'm not a huge fan of his, but like, I'm supposed to be on this hate train?
Yeah.
Did you hate? Were you happy watching him?
I dislike Johnny Manziel.
Right.
My weird mind, the way it was working was, this stinks, because I'm rooting against the guy. I don't know why, but I shouldn't, because I know he's talented and all. But my weird mind is, you know, he's going to wind up with a team that's halfway decent, and he's going to be like Ben Roethlisberger, where he's just put into the right situation, he's going to win games, and blah, blah, blah. That didn't occur, but that's what I was saying. I wasn't really – I mean, to me, I had a feeling that he was going to drop far out of this top five. I just had this feeling that's how it was going. So I just – you know, and then when you saw, like, where he got past – the top 10, you're like, well, where is he going to go now? So I guess it was a different fear of it, but, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I see your point, dude. I mean, I was looking at it, I guess, in a little bit of a different way, but we are going to go out to the Tucci Lumber Hotline right now to Coach Mark Smith. He is the former coach of Johnny Manziel in high school at Kerryville High. Coach, are you with us?
I'm here. Yes, sir.
Coach, we really appreciate you joining us on a Wednesday night. We know you're a busy guy. The first question I have for you is any of this stuff with Johnny surprising to you at all? All the stuff he kind of went through, dropping down the board to Cleveland, did any of that surprise you at all, having known him over the years?
Well, I mean, it probably surprised me because everybody was projecting so high. But, you know, it's kind of like when he was recruited out of high school. I mean, nothing surprises me. You never know what people are really looking for. The main thing is I think all along, everybody thought Cleveland was the place he was going to wind up, and Cleveland found a way to maneuver and get some other picks and still get Johnny. So in the end, it all works out. The bottom line, he's the number one draft pick. He's got an opportunity to compete for a position and play in the NFL. What more could you ask for as a 21-year-old?
Coach, was this the kind of same kind of thing you saw as he signed with A&M out of high school? Was this the same kind of stuff people were saying, the old mantra, he's too small, he's not this, he doesn't have the arm strength? Is this kind of the same exact thing that was going on then, or was A&M just saying he's going to be our starter in a couple of years after a redshirt?
No, I think it's funny. I think there's so many parallels between him being recruited out of high school into college and now from going to college to the pros. I mean, there's a lot of questions, and a lot of it has to do with the size. A lot of it has to do with the throw in motion. Back at that point in high school, it was, can he throw the football well enough? Is he more of a runner? Everybody knew he's an athlete. It was just a matter of would he be a quarterback and how would he transition into college? And so there's a lot of parallels to it and a lot of things that you see and hear.
Do you think, Coach, that it's more kind of the stuff that people were talking about on draft day? Do you think it's more of the off-the-field stuff he's had with, you know, the money fingers and some of the trouble he got into with some fraternity parties, or do you think it's more of a football-based kind of issue that these NFL clubs had with him?
Well, I would probably say it's a little bit of both. You know, I'm sure him growing and maturing and going through some of the tribulations he did as a young man, I'm sure that raised some red flags for some people. But and some of it probably is again just the evaluations of what people look at and all the prototypical quarterback stuff that people look for in the NFL quarterback. So I think there was multiple things that maybe raised some red flags. But the one thing nobody could deny and nobody could really, to me, say is a knock is he wins. He knows how to win and he knows how to compete. And he will do everything he can to become the best quarterback he can in the NFL. I just wish sometimes more people would stop and listen to what he has to say instead of all the things that sometimes the media makes out to be that he is. When you really listen to him close, the things that bother him the most from high school to college were the fact that he didn't help his teams win championships, that he didn't help us at Kerrville at the time win a state championship. He didn't help lead A&M to a national championship. His whole goal now at Cleveland is to help the Cleveland Browns win a Super Bowl. So however he's got to do that, he's going to try to make that happen.
Coach, this is Mike DePalma. We're up here in Connecticut where high school football is slightly less important than down your way down in Texas. So you must see guys like Johnny Manziel, like not of his quality, but, you know, guys that you know, this is a Division I, player. When did you know Johnny Manziel was going to be a star? At what age when you saw him? Was he a kid that coming up in the eighth grade, you're like, we got this kid going to join the program? Or was he somebody that grew on you? When was the moment that you said, we got something special here in Johnny football?
Well, I thought his freshman year, there was a few games that he played as a freshman. You look at it and you go, holy cow, this guy's different. He's always been a little bit, and I don't mean physically, but mentally, the way he carried himself, to me, he was always a little bit more mature in the way he handled himself than a lot of normal kids. You can watch him on a football field. He was a little bit different than the rest in the way that he played. His abilities were so much a little bit above. I mean, you could kind of tell. I don't think anybody could project what's happened for him now. I mean, there's no doubt about it. But you knew that he had an opportunity to do some great things in college and be a good football player. So, really, I'm going to tell you, he's a pretty good athlete, period. He could have been a pro golfer if he chose to do that, probably. So, he made a decision and went to football, and it's all been good for him.
Now we've had guys like Sean Salisbury on the show, analysts like that. We've had former NFL players, Jerry Rice, on the show, and we always ask them, how do you try to project? Because there's a billion-dollar industry of trying to project these guys and whether their attributes are going to transfer from the high school level to the collegiate level, which Johnny obviously it did, and whether that skill set is going to translate from the collegiate level to the NFL level. Are you, as a high school coach of a guy who's probably coached, dozens and dozens of Division I players and guys that have gone drafted, how good are you at projecting this? And if you're good, I mean, what do you project Johnny Manziel being?
I wish I was good.
I'll
tell you what, I don't know if anybody could truly project anything. Well, let's look at probably one of the best quarterbacks in the game today, Tom Brady. Now, I think everybody picked him in the wrong spot. So, look at him. I don't think anybody projected him to be nothing more than really just a backup journeyman quarterback, and look what he's done. I don't know if anybody can really project. I think you look at it, you got some ideas, and you hope things work. I do know this about Johnny Manziel. He is competitive. He will do what he needs to make himself the best quarterback he can. He's going to work at it. And he's a heck of a leader and a heck of a young man. I mean, he's going to do the things that he needs to help himself. He's surrounding himself with people that will help in that. So I think I think he's going to have an opportunity to do some great things. And to me, like Tom Rossley and Mike Sermon said, he has a lot of Brett Favre qualities about him. So if he can channel it and do it right, I think he could do some great things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that aspect, which is something you can't quantify, that like there's an it factor to all these quarterbacks. And believe me, I mean, I played quarterback in high school, and you put me in shorts and a T-shirt, I can make the throws, but I did not have that it factor where, man, these guys are coming at you, and it moves fast, and that's at the high school level in Connecticut, you know what I mean? So when he's
right.
getting recruited, how do you – I guess this goes for any recruit as a high school coach down in Texas, where I'm sure you're talking to a lot of collegiate coaches – how do you quantify that? How do you quantify what Johnny does, which might not show up on film in high school or might not show up in a workout, that you say when this guy, like you said, he just knows how to win. He knows how to make a play on a 3rd and 8 to move the chains. He knows how to do that. How do you go about quantifying that to collegiate coaches that are recruiting your players?
Well, one, I hope the college coaches can trust me enough. And no doubt we had to sell Johnny just like we sell other kids. I mean, there's no doubt there's always going to be the freaks like Jadeveon Clowney and those guys. But, you know, those guys, too, you got to hope they pan out. So, but you try to sell your kids. You try to make sure they understand. The biggest thing I try to do with Johnny is just remind people how many guys passed on another quarterback that they thought was too short and threw the ball funny by the name of Drew Brees that was in the state of Texas. I had a good friend that coached him when he was at Westlake, and a lot of the same things they said about Drew Brees, they were saying about Johnny. You know, his height's the question, his throwing motion's the question. Well, all that I know is you got to learn how to factor in winning, and the guy knows how to win. And I think a lot of people learn that the hard way, that once he went to A&M and did some things. I'm just happy that A&M stuck with him and kept recruiting him and saw enough in him that it worked out for him.
Coach, this is Dan again. I'm just curious, since the draft, have you spoken to Johnny? Has he given you a call? Have you called him? Have you had any contact with him in any way?
The biggest thing, we just kind of texted back and forth. The big thing, he's excited. I was excited for him. I know he's busy. I just told him once things settle down, give me a call. But he's excited about the opportunity. He's going to go in and compete and be the best he can and learn all he can and just soak it up. And to let the chips fall where they may. The one thing I know about Johnny, he does know this. It's still a game, and he's going to have fun playing the game. Games were meant to be fun, and he's going to play it and compete to the best of his abilities, and don't worry about the rest of it. So he's going to do all he can.
Coach, do you see any kind of comparisons, any parallels between him and a guy like Russell Wilson? Because, you know, Russell's a guy everybody talks about. He's not 6 feet tall. He's not this. He's not that. He didn't have the most unbelievable combine. And, you know, then there he is, quarterbacking in Seattle, and all they do is win a Super Bowl. So do you see any of that? Because everything you hear from Coach Carroll is Russell just knows how to win, operate an offense. Do you see any of that, or do you see Johnny being maybe a little bit different than him?
No, I see a lot of the same things. I mean, I really do. I think as you talk to people and you talk to guys that have kind of compared all that, I mean, I really do. I think I've said it all along from the time that Mike Sherman and Tom Rossi and those guys were recruiting him. He's got a Brett Favre mentality. He's got a gunslinger mentality, and he's got Russell Wilson's ability. So he's got that combination of all the skill sets that go with it. He's got something in his brain that, I mean, he's got that it factor that makes things happen. He's not afraid to take on a challenge. I think he commands the respect of his teammates. Not that he's arrogant or anything like that, but I think they're going to see that he's going to work just as hard as they are, and he's going to expect as much out of himself as he does anybody else. You know, when you look at it, I mean, Russell Wilson's under 6 feet, Drew Brees under 6 feet, so there are quarterbacks that can be successful in the NFL, and you don't have to be 6'5". There's no doubt it's been shown it can be done, and I think Johnny fits that mold perfectly.
Coach, I'm a huge college football fan, and I know football in Texas is huge. Do you have any guys in your program now, maybe coming up the pike, that are guys to keep an eye on for a college football fan over the next few years?
Well, I mean, we always got kids that I think got a chance to go on to college and do some great things, but I'm going to tell you, if I ever get to coach another one like Johnny Manziel, I'll be one lucky sucker now. I'm telling you. Because I don't know how much we coached him. You just kind of directed him and let him do his thing. But, no, he just and I don't mean that in a bad way. He was a great kid, took coaching very well. I mean, he's a great leader. But if I could find another Johnny, I'd be living high on the hog. I'll tell you that right now. So.
Yeah, I can imagine. We had LeBron James' high school coach on last week, who's now the head coach up at Akron, and, you know, said a lot of the same things you're saying about Johnny, leader, you know, knew, you know, just had a better mind for the game at a young age. So, it's great to hear. I mean, I love talking to the high school coaches because they're going to give you the most honest opinion. And so, you know, that's why I really appreciate you taking the time. I got one last question. It's from a Northeast guy. I mean, we romanticize Texas high school football. Like, we just think of it as like a Hollywood story. You know what I mean? We watch Friday Night Lights and all the rest. So how much of that aspect of this is true? I mean, how many times are you getting knocked on the door by, like, the sheriff saying, hey, you got to go pull so-and-so out of the, you know? Is that any of that true, that the whole town is just, is like, protecting these kids? I mean, give us a sense of high school football. Give it, you know, to the New Englanders up here.
Well, I'll tell you, it's big and it's important. I think sometimes it's kind of blown out of proportion, what you see on TV. But as far as big crowds and people supporting the programs and people being excited about football, there's no doubt that's true. I mean, there's some big crowds. There's a lot of people that are supportive of it. But we do expect our kids to become great men, too. And we're trying to do all we can to help them grow as people. And that will always be an aspect of it. We all want to win on the football field, no doubt. But I think as much as anything, we're all trying to help these young men win at life also and help them to be productive citizens when it's all said and done, because football's going to end at some point. So we just try to help them that way. And it is important. It's important in the state of Texas. And we're going to always – I think that will always be that way for a long, long time.
I can imagine. Well, Coach, I wish you the best of luck, and we wish Johnny the best of luck, and it'd be nice for you to see one of your players playing on Sundays. That's gonna be a cool story to tell your team and your family and the rest. So we wish you all the best, Coach. I really appreciate your time here on a Wednesday night.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on. God bless you, and have a good evening, man.
All right, have a great evening. Thank you, Coach.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Bye bye.
I mean, I am fascinated. This is probably the fourth or fifth high school coach of a star that we've had. You know, we had LeBron's coach on. We had Rich Hoffman, who's obviously Alex Rodriguez's coach. I'm always fascinated by these stories of because they're going to give you an insight that nobody else can give you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you always think they're not going to come out here and tell you horror stories, although Rich Hoffman did give some insight about this kid. Like, he got a sense that the kid was fragile even back then and lived in a little cocoon of his friends and took, like, sanctuary in the baseball field and the rest because he had, you know, came from a poor family. So you did get some insight there. I love talking to those guys. I would love to have a weekly thing. We just talk to a famous person's high school teacher. We'd just get, like, you know, Brad Pitt's high school drama teacher on something.
Yeah, I mean, we do have Coach Ireland there.
Coach
Ireland. So, you know what's amazing to me when you talk about like Coach there is when we were like 16, 17 playing ball together, how different you were, how kind of childish you were.
Oh, yeah.
And now if you go on to play in the big leagues, NHL, whatever, the stories people could tell about the Mike DePalma of the 1997 North American Legion team would be so different.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know what I mean? So those guys know that stuff. That jackass
used to set up diving catches in the middle of big games just because he wanted to tell his teammates he made a diving catch. I used to do that.
Right. I mean, I was tempted to ask him, but I didn't want it to be kind of like a shallow question. But like when Johnny's doing the money fingers and he's kind of hot-dogging and he's being a showboat, is that shocking to you as his former coach? But I didn't want to be like, I don't know.
We're not that sure.
But I'm curious because I don't know if you changed that much.
I can't imagine he was still doing that.
You had
back
to have
then.
That kind of edge to
but
him.
But I think that helps him. We talk about that
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, very well
the
good.
Guys that have that edge to him, I told you, like Jose Reyes, they tone Jose Reyes down. He's never been the same player as he was back in 06 and 05 when he was the electric guy. I think the same thing can happen with Yasiel Puig. You saw it last night. If you watched any of the game last night, it was on the MLB Network. It was his bobblehead night, and he knew it. It was a big game, and he's out there making diving catches and hitting missiles one hop in the fence, and you're like, he could live in that moment. Like, it clearly helps him. There's no way you could deny that energy that he brings, as much of it's like, you know, I think Carlos Gomez is the same way, and as much of a jackass as you think he is, he would not be the same player if he didn't have that jackass edge. So I think the same thing with Johnny Manziel.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it. I would have no problem with it in baseball if they just went back to the way it used to be. If you could just throw guys.
Well, did you see what happened today in today's today it was the Orioles against the Tigers, and they had a bench-clearing altercation either last night or the night before where Torrey Hunter got hit. Both no throws or anything like that. Well, today Verlander throws behind. They're up like 5 or 6 to nothing. So he throws in like the fourth inning. He throws behind Nelson Cruz, gets a warning, all the rest. Next at bat, now it's the game 6-2. Nelson Cruz hits a 3-run home run, makes it 6-5, and it was just like that. I love that aspect of the game. That's why I like it. The fact that he came up in the next at bat and went yard on a pitch. It was a nasty slider down, and he just threw his barrel down at the bat and hit it out to left. And you're like, that. I love that aspect. So you're taking it out, taking that like aggressiveness out of it. Like to me, that's what makes sports enjoyable.
Absolutely.
You want to know who I want to hear from?
I do.
Our good friend out in Hoboken, comedian extraordinaire Neil Lynch. Neil.
Hey, I'm here.
You're here, brother. Are you just, I mean, you are you working on? I know you've got your big comedy set. It's this Monday, right?
It's this Monday at the Gotham Comedy Club on 23rd Street at 7 p.m.
So it's some sort of competition, and you're going to be representing us, I'm assuming, with the just PSD swag all over the place. So you coming up with a new set, or are you just doing like a best of set?
No, it's all new. It's all new. I got three sets. 3 5-minute sets that I'm playing around with right now, and I'm either going to pick one of them or I'm going to do a mixture of all three. I'm going to like a training session on Saturday morning. I'm going to get on my Rocky Balboa shorts and climb a mountain and yell. I'm psyched. It's New York's funniest professional stand-up comedy contest, and it's kind of weird because if you were to ask any of my coworkers, is Neil a funny guy, they would spit in your face because I'm not like that at work.
No, and I got to tell you, Neil, Mike told me when he went to see your show, impressive. I've seen some of your clips online. You're a funny guy, but I want to know this. I mean, is it more kind of imposing going on stage at Gotham or sitting here on the Tri-State Sports Guys talking with me and Mike?
I tell you, you guys, you really have upped the ante in terms of sports talk radio. I mean, I don't get the kind of information from a lot of other stations as I do from you guys. And you guys make me feel like a full-on mentally challenged person. Like I haven't been a sports fan for the past 33 years. It's just like it's like I've been living under a rock. So I'd say there's way more pressure here than in front of a crowd of, 200 people that just want to laugh.
Well, that's a lot of BS, but I appreciate it. I want to get your opinion because Mike and I kind of got into it at the beginning of the show, but what were your thoughts on the New York Rangers? Because you and I broke it down like two professionals a couple weeks ago. We both agreed Philly, no way Philly loses to them. So we both sold the Rangers down the river. And now here they are beating Pittsburgh. So just give me your thoughts on it last night. I mean, how happy were you, A, to see Crosby upset? And then what were your thoughts on the Rangers winning?
Well, I couldn't be happier to see Pittsburgh take a hike. I know my mother all of a sudden is like a tremendous Blue Shirts fan. I don't know where that came from because we were pretty much a Devils household / Bruins household for a long time. She's now anti-Bruins, even though my father was a Bruins fan. I pretty much tuned out from that series when it was 3-1 Pittsburgh. I saw the kind of shot production that New York was putting up. I mean, when you're getting below 20 shots a game, I don't know how you expect to win. And then Martin St. Louis' mother passes away, and the team rallies around him. He kind of uses it as inspiration and motivation to come out and have a Disney-type moment where he scores. They're blocking shots like they were back in 2012. And once it got to Game 7, it was almost like a foregone conclusion that these guys were gonna seal it, because you look at who they have on that team, and they're battle-tested in Game 7. So, I mean, the only Game 7 loss that a lot of those guys had was to my New Jersey Devils. So, I'm pretty pumped to see them go on. I know that you guys were talking about the fact that in a lot of other sports, like if the Giants see the Jets progress, or Giants fans see Jets win in the playoffs, that we're suddenly going to be anti-Jets. I don't know that that's really the case with the Devils and the Rangers. I know there's a bitter rivalry there, but I don't know who I would hate on the Rangers team enough to root against them. And the Flyers are totally another bag of tricks. I mean, I had them winning, but I didn't want them to win. And, I'd be rooting against them till the day I die. But with the Rangers, considering the other competition in the Eastern Conference, I didn't want to see Pittsburgh. I could care less if Montreal goes to the Cup. And, I don't really want to see Boston win again, but I'm rooting for Boston, New York, because I think that could be really cool. Just knowing the two cities' history, with the Knicks and Celtics and with the Giants and Patriots, Jets, I mean, that would just be huge for the NHL.
I said to Mike earlier that I think there's something in Islanders and Devils fans that I, at least guys I know, that see that the Rangers can do something for the betterment of the game that our fan bases can't. I mean, you look at the Devils a couple years ago in the Cup Finals against L.A., the ratings were abysmal. You know what I mean? The Islanders are wholly irrelevant now. But the Rangers have this place, and I think with Montreal up 2-1 right now at the end of 2 up in Boston, I've argued that I could see the series being great either way, but I think with some of the guys I know that are Canadian, there's a hatred for Montreal that spans from BC to Halifax. Like, there's pretty much a hatred for them by just about everybody. And you could actually have almost an entire continent rooting for the Rangers. I mean, isn't that cool on some level? Whereas if it's New York and Boston, it's just kind of like this little corridor between, I-95 or wherever it is that they'll get up to Boston. But Montreal would be that Darth Vader kind of matchup. I mean, couldn't that be awesome for the game, or am I just blowing this way out of proportion because I'm a hockey head?
I mean, possibly. I don't know. I mean, I think that New York could definitely make something more of it. I think we could definitely turn it into something that's more heated than it would be if it were another team like maybe Philly or, Pittsburgh. So, I think, like you said, it would be a good series either way. I think the goaltending will be great. As you said, Price is playing fantastic right now, as is Rask and Hank. So, I personally, it's not like Montreal's lame, like the Spurs. They bring, certain bulletin board material to it. I mean, they got a lot of fire and passion, and I think Boston has as well, so. You're looking at a really good Eastern Conference final. I was just upset to see the Wild eliminated because I didn't want to see Chicago advance. But, you're going to get a good battle from Chicago or L.A. and better numbers with Chicago, L.A. in the final.
Neil, you were the only guy here for it, and I've been begging for some credit for a little while now. My upset pick when you and I broke down the first round of the playoffs was essentially, I hate the way they reseeded it now, but the 2-7 matchup was Colorado and Minnesota, and Santa was on board with the Wild. I'm just saying. I mean, I was happy to see him lose to Chicago because I'm a huge Duncan Keith, Jonathan Tate fan. But just a little bit of credit. I mean, did you hear any of the Barry Melroses of the world or John Buchagrosses giving you that kind of insight into the Minnesota Wild's grit overcoming the young Avalanche? Did you get that anywhere else but right here on the Tri-State Sportscast?
No, that was an exclusive. I think we can shout that from the mountaintops. I mean, the big story in that series with the Wild and Avalanche was Nate MacKinnon, the rookie. I mean, he was just like playing out of his mind, and I think a lot of people were kind of rooting for them to advance just to see more of him. But I personally was glad to see the Wild advance, and it stinks that Chicago just basically overpowered him behind Crawford and Taze.
Yeah, I mean that's an interesting story. MacKinnon. I mean, he's a kid. He's 18 years old, won't be 19 until September. And if this were going on in any other sport, obviously it can't go on in football, but if this were going on in the NBA 10 years ago, it would be like the LeBron James thing, but no one cares because it's hockey. But more important than that to me is what I said to Mike before, and he doesn't seem to care, and God, because he's getting into hockey a little bit, but do you realize there's an opportunity for back-to-back Original Six Stanley Cup Finals? I mean, none since 1979. Now we could go back-to-back, Neil. Am I wrong to be excited about that?
No, absolutely not. And I think that that's exactly what the NHL needs. But, I think they need it, but at the same time, it also, kind of puts a crimp in broadening the fan base and giving the other teams exposure to maybe get a new fan base. So in that respect, it's kind of a downer because you would like to see, ideally, an original six team against an up-and-coming team that is, can bring on a new set of fans, young set of fans. Much like you guys were talking about the Mets and the Yankees, like when you're growing up in the 80s, the Mets kind of had the edge over the Yankees, especially in the mid to late 80s, so that more kids were growing up to want to be Mets fans. And then if you're growing up in the early 90s, mid-90s, to late 90s and early 2000s, the Yankees were the dominant team. So you see a lot more younger kids go with the Yankees. So, Original Six is great and all, but they have their established fan bases. What you're looking to do is build upon the territories that are up and coming, like the Minnesota Wild that had the North Stars but lost them. I guess Anaheim. I can't take Anaheim seriously. It's a Disney franchise, for crying out loud.
that's a good one right there. I mean, that's I'm actually rooting for the Kings, but for different reasons, but I see exactly what you're saying there. But now, just to get your insight, because you mentioned the Mets-Yankees series, I listened to Mike Bowe earlier, diehard Mets fan. Does this series now, I'm looking at it, Yankees are up 3-0 in the bottom of the sixth, but the Mets obviously took the first two games, and, in an emphatic way in both games, kind of. Does this do anything for you? Because I know you've been the downtrodden Mets fan while Mike is the upbeat, positive guy. But does this mean anything to you, or is this just kind of like what the Yankees fans are saying? This is just the middle of May, stupid series that no one should care about. Are you excited?
I am sad to report I'm not excited. We have another Mets fan in my office who got really excited that we put a licking on the Yankees, and it's like, yeah, but who did we face from a pitching standpoint? And what kind of lineup were we facing? I mean, the Yankees are really banged up right now. I mean, Tex is on the DL. You have Ichiro with a back issue. I mean, Beltran now has some kind of bruise somewhere. So, I mean, they only really have, Jeter's getting up there in age. You have Solarte, who's like their up-and-coming star. Ellsbury is playing, fairly decent. And then you have McCann. And Roberts is, in my mind, underperforming. So, I mean, I don't think they're playing the 100% Yankees. Whereas the Mets, other than maybe their bullpen, are fairly healthy. I'd say 100%. So, it's good to, I'll take the W's. But, like tonight when they were facing Tanaka, different story. I mean, they're getting shut out. And they're back in their ballpark, their own ballpark, where they just can't hit the ball. But you can see if they play in a ballpark like Yankee Stadium, they can put up runs because they're hitting home runs that are basically either flyouts, lineouts, or, doubles. So, I mean, if they can get 3 of 4, I'm fairly satisfied with that. But I want to see them play against the teams like the playoff caliber teams and stick with them. That's what I'd like to see.
I have to say this, and I've told Mike this off the air on different occasions with things, but watching the Cubs beat the Cardinals 17-5 the other night was like maybe the greatest baseball game I've watched in as far back as I can remember. Like, it was just that thrilling knowing that the Cardinals are just eons better. They're a better franchise. They're better run. They're better managed. It doesn't seem to matter what they do. Everything goes right. But to watch that, watch the Cubs, watch Junior Lake have a big game, Rizzo, Olt hit a bomb, it means the world to me because I know they're going nowhere. But Met fans seem to be different in a way, or at least the guys I know. It's as though you're not that good right now, but you feel like you're holding yourself up to some standard. I guess Cubs fans, we just don't see. We don't compare ourselves to the Cardinals because think most of the time. The White Sox got their World Series. What is the difference, Neil, between the Met fan surrounded by all that it is that you just have Big Brother looking down his nose with 27 titles and calling you guys like just the worst franchise ever? Or are you guys just better adjusted to life than the Cubs fan that we just are so thrilled with anything good that happens for our team?
Well, I mean, I definitely, I pump my fist when Duda got the broken bat single or double to score Campbell, and Campbell barely, got past the tag. I mean, I'm not saying I didn't get pumped a little bit. I, you know, you could hear it in the double play to end the game where Duda made that great play, and you know there are moments where you can't help but get excited. But in terms of overall outlook and scope, you know, there's a glimmer of hope. I'm not going to look at this series and say, oh, this is the series that turns around. But hey, if you can get this lineup to stay consistent and healthy. Eric Young is a firecracker. He's a headlight. He gets on base. He steals a base. Someone hits him over. Someone hits him in. That's a run every time he gets on base. You know, if Daniel Murphy and if Grandy can come along, you know, Grandy's had an outstanding series against the Yankees. If he can hit like he's hitting now, you know, if they can keep this lineup intact and produce like they are, then, you know, we have a shot at a wild card. But, you know, I mentioned this in the article after that first effing game. That's not them. That's not 162-game Mets. That's like a series Mets. The Mets that I know have a month where everyone gets hurt. They have a month where everyone decides we're not going to hit or we're going to blow every save opportunity. So, like, that's how it's so hard for me to look at this series and get too much hope. You know, I'm saying to myself, you know, 1-9, we're looking pretty good. Starting pitching looking pretty good. Bullpen still kind of sucks. But if they can continue to produce hits and produce functional outs, then, yeah, we can win the majority of series. But, see, I don't think we have that kind of longevity and that consistency to do it.
Well, I got to tell you this, Neil. We're going to step away, take a quick commercial break. But first, I just want to say I feel this funny feeling in my stomach because I'm kind of pulling for the Mets and I'm pulling for the Rangers. I don't know what to do with it. I'm just going to try to turn it into some good positive energy as I go forward in my life. But we're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back with the Tri-State Sports Guys.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Really, Really, Really Bad Dancer.
Mr. Really, Really, Really Bad Dancer.
Arms swinging, knees bending, head bobbing to no particular rhythm. You're either dancing or you have fleas.
Call me the doctor.
As soon as you hit the dance floor, the taunts begin. Is that all you got, playa? Unfortunately, yes. That's all you got.
Pour it on now.
Who's in the house? Some guy who can't dance. That's who's in the house.
You're done.
So crack open an ice cold Bud Light, Mr. Happy Feet, because you really put the oogie in boogie.
Mr. Really, really bad dancer.
All right, we are back. We're the Tri-State Sports Guys. We're having a beautiful show tonight. We're going to go out now to the Tucci Lumber Hotline to a very special guest, former Buffalo Bill, Mr. Thurman Thomas. Thurman, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here, man. How's it going?
It's going great. We're really honored to have you on. The first thing I want to get into a little bit of is, what did you think about the Sammy Watkins draft pick? You know, your Bills gave away quite a bit to get him to move up a first rounder next year. Were you as excited as Bills fans seem to be with that pick?
Well, I am. This was the first time that I actually got a chance to be in a draft war room with Russ Brandon, Doug Marrone, Doug Whaley, and a couple other off of the scouts and some of the other employees. And so it was a fun time. I knew that they had been wanting Sammy for a long time. Yes, obviously, you know, everybody talks about, you know, giving up the first-round pick for next year. But, you know, I'm looking for EJ to have a great year. And so if he has a great year and Sammy is involved with that, you know, that pick next year doesn't mean anything. You know, you just pick in and put players in where you need them the most. But I thought overall it was a great pick. And, you know, I got a chance to talk to the young man about a week ago, and a very mature young man for 20 years old. And the thing that I liked about him, he wants to work. He wants to come here And, you know, he wants to, he told me on the side, he wants to rewrite the record books that Andre Reed set. So when you have that type of goal, and if he can compete and come in here and compete and have EJ have a good year, you know, hopefully this team can break the streak and get into the playoffs.
Thurman, when you watch those guys, when you look at a college football game or you watch film of any of those guys, do you see that much of a disparity? Because we've had the discussion on here a few times between a Sammy Watkins or a Brandon Cooks, a Marquise Lee. Is it something, you know, as a Hall of Fame player, does it jump off the page to you when you watch those guys on film? Or do you just look at it like we got one of the good wide receivers? Or do you really feel like he is clear-cut the best one?
No, I think when I watch Sammy and I watch him over the year, I got a chance to watch a lot of Clemson football games. You can tell that, you know what, they were wanting to get him the ball every single time. Oh, I mean, I was surprised that they didn't put him on defense. So, I mean, that's how, you know, exciting of a player, how explosive of a player. And there were sometimes some instances where, you know, as a young receiver, you know, really coming into the league, you know, one of the things that he's going to have to do is really learn to get off the line of scrimmage. This league is a kind of a bump and run. A lot of teams really in this division play man-to-man. You know, obviously with the Patriots getting Darrell Revis, the Jets always play man-to-man most of the time. So, and the Dolphins do too. So, but on film, you look at it and say, yeah, this guy has definitely – separated himself from the rest of the guys. Now you look at a guy like, you know, like Mike Evans. Obviously, having Johnny Manziel, you know, the numbers are going to be there because of the scrambling and because of, you know, the way Johnny played when he was at Texas A&M, and Mike Evans was a big part of that. But when you see Sammy Watkins, you know, he's, you know, they say he's 6 foot, maybe 6'1". No, he plays like he's about 6'5". And the one thing that I really like about he's very, very physical, good run after the catch, and that's what you're looking in a wide receiver. He catches the ball over the middle also.
Thurman, I got to ask you, as a former workhorse running back, Hall of Fame player, what do you make of Bishop Sankey, first running back taken, coming off in the middle of the second round? Is it just as simple nowadays as these teams are running these platoon two-back systems? Is that kind of heartbreaking to you in a way? Because I'm a guy who likes to watch running backs run. I mean, now all of a sudden they're coming off in the middle of the second round.
Yeah, I hate it. You know, I talked to Marcus Allen and Eric Dixon a couple of weeks ago before the draft, and, you know, and they were saying, you know, we need to start a petition or something because they're just not using a running back like they used to do it anymore. Obviously, it's a passing league, and when you have guys like, you know, you have guys like Drew Brees, Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, Eli, I mean, obviously you're going to throw the ball a lot more, but I tell you what, you look at a team like Seattle, I don't think Seattle gets to the playoffs. Even though their defense played tremendously, I don't think they get to the playoffs without Marshawn Lynch. And I don't think they win the Super Bowl without Marshawn Lynch. I think he brought that physicality to the football game when they needed for him to, you know, pick up the tough yards in the fourth quarter. They needed that, and they used him very, very well. And so I think it's just something that we're just seeing right now. But when it all comes down to it, teams will use the running back. They will, you know, platoon guys in and out. But I think once you see all of these great passers that we're seeing right now in our time, I think when we see them go and disappear, we're not going to see the likes of that for a long, long time, I think. I mean, because, you know, Brady and the guys that I named, those guys are special. And you're going to have to try to find somebody like that in college. And I just don't know if guys like that are going to come around for the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I agree with you, Thurman. This is Mike DePalm. I agree with you. I think we get a little spoiled when you see the talent that's been coming into the league. You get a little spoiled. Now, let me ask you this. You mentioned you were in the war room there on draft day. Now, as a player, and even as a fan, like we look at things, you know, like anybody could do this job. Oh, you know, pick out the good players. Take us through what that's like, and does that give you a better appreciation to what the front office does? And when you were a player, did you appreciate the work that goes into what these guys do, or are you just like, let me get out there and play?
No, you know what? Being in the war room, being in you see the type of work that, and even before the draft, you know, these guys were putting in work. The scouts were here 2 weeks before the draft, getting all their notes together. So, yeah, I really appreciate it a little bit more now that I got to see what Doug Whaley and all those guys were doing, you know, making phone calls and you know, trying to, you know, see what Cleveland is doing, see what Jacksonville is doing. And when Jacksonville took Blake Bortles, I mean, the room exploded because Whaley was like, oh, my God, we didn't feel like this was going to happen, you know. And so, I mean, and within a matter of 30 seconds, man, he was on the phone calling Ray Former in Cleveland. And actually, as stuff has came out now, you know, Cleveland was one of those teams that wanted Sammy Watkins to probably team him with Josh Gordon. Unfortunately, Josh Gordon got suspended. So now they're probably thinking, well, we should have took Sammy. But they were on the phone, man, immediately. And I had never seen a reaction like that. Like I said, that was my first time being in it. But, you know, they were on the phone the whole entire time trying to get entice Cleveland to take what they were giving them, and Cleveland took it. So and the room just exploded, and you can tell that they made the trade, and you know they got the guy that they wanted, and it's something that hopefully I'll be involved with every single year now.
Yeah, you know, we always joke around on the show about these, you know, draft boards that come out, these projected draft or mock drafts that come out the day after the season ends, or even during the season they come out. And they're a joke because they never are close to being right. And so now that you've been, and now that you're an insider and you see what's going on, do you guys read it and kind of laugh a little bit, like these guys have no idea what they're talking about? Or do you use it at all? Do you take it as like maybe they do have some inside information? Or, how is that perceived inside the war room?
I think, you know, when you look at it, you know, a lot of it is guessing. A lot of guys, you know, do predict sometimes, you know, they might take this guy. And while I was there for the first three picks, you know, you hear Mary Kuiper. You know, only one that they were really sure about was Clowney, really. But they really wasn't sure about that because they didn't know what Texas was going to do. I thought the Texans did what they were supposed to do in taking Clowney. But I think once it got down to Jacksonville, you know, a lot of those experts were saying that they were supposed to take Jake Matthews from Texas A&M. So as you look at it, you look and say, you know, maybe some guys have a little insight, and some guys probably don't, as much as Todd Machey, Mel Kiper Jr. Probably those guys, you know, when you do 25 or 30 mock drafts, obviously you're going to get one right probably. You're going to get a little bit more wrong, you know, so. I think when you do more mock drafts, you have an opportunity to maybe pick a couple of right in a row. But I think overall, you know, it's really kind of a guessing game because, you know, those guys are not, you know, out scouting guys. They don't know what the Bills are thinking with their head coach, offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator.
Thurman, this is Dan again. This is our last question for you. I'm sitting alongside our world-class producer, Tony D, who's a diehard Bills fan for years now. And, you know, he's just curious, and we're curious, you know, with the passing of the late, great Ralph Wilson, and now you've sat through the first draft in the war room with the team. I mean, with all the things going on up in Buffalo, what are your thoughts on just the general direction of the organization as a whole right now?
Well, you know what, I obviously, you know, it was a blow to the Buffalo Bills organization and the Buffalo Bills community when Mr. Wilson passed, but I think Mr. Wilson – before he passed, he knew that he wanted the Buffalo Bills to stay in Western New York, to be here in the city of Buffalo, in the Western New York area. And I do believe that one of the people, whoever it may be, will step up and continue to have the Bills remain here in Buffalo. I know Roger Goodell has spoke very highly and very fierce about keeping the Bills here in Buffalo. Matter of fact, I just talked to Governor Cuomo today, and he was you know, he gave me the exact words. He's going to do everything in his power to keep the Bills here. So, you know, there's always going to be conversation about, you know, getting the team and maybe moving it. But I tell you what, I had a great conversation 2 days ago with my buddy Jim Kelly over at his house. And, you know, he's really excited about his group that he has to be able to keep the team here in Buffalo. And so with everything that Jim has always believed in, it usually come true. So, and with that, you know, I would ask everybody who's listening tonight just to say a prayer for my buddy Jim. You know, he's feeling a little bit better, but there's still a long way to go. He has some more radiation treatment to go, and he has another chemo session coming up in a couple of weeks. So just keep him in your prayers. And like I said, he told me he's doing everything he possibly can to keep the team in Buffalo, and I truly believe that.
Well, Thurman, listen, we'll be keeping Jim in our prayers. We appreciate your time. And we here at the Tri-State Sports Guys believe wholeheartedly that football belongs in Buffalo. So thank you again, and all the best to you, your Bills, Jim Kelly, everything up in Buffalo. Thank you.
All right, man. You guys have a great night.
Thanks, man. That's the great Thurman Thomas. I mean, does Tony D want
to
talk?
I mean, yeah, Tony, you got anything to say? It's Thurman Thomas, bro. Yeah. Like, that's Dean's Ernie. That's your Ernie Banks. No, I mean, it's got to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't even talk. I'm speechless. I need to watch more
cigarette
after that.
I know. I think so.
That was great.
I mean, that was it was so, you know, perfect because we were just talking at the beginning of the show about some of the great NFL owners. That, you know, we were talking about the NHL and how these guys had they think about the league. And Ralph Wilson clearly was one of the guys who thought about the league first and did it that way. And to have Thurman Thomas chime in here and give us insight into the war, there's always something I'm curious about.
Can we stop busting my chops now about my face when Ernie calls in?
I know.
Everybody likes to get a kick out of me. No, and Tony knows.
And Tony did not know that Thurman Thomas was calling in. We didn't know.
No, we didn't.
Until very late into the show here that he was going to be calling in. So
Who's yours? Is it Chad Pennington?
I'll be honest with you. My one guy, I still think it's Ricky Henderson. My guy,
really?
Like Ricky Henderson as a kid. I had the posters even when he came to the Mets. I loved them. Like, Ricky Henderson was my all-time favorite baseball player. The guy that I think I – but, you know, and he'd be an entertaining interview. But the guy that I probably would want to talk to the most, like, would –
Mo
like,
Vaughn.
Well, Mo would be another one in there. But
right.
I think it probably would be Chad. It might be Chad. Although I want to talk to Derek Coleman now, obviously, the safety out – I mean, the fullback out in Seattle. I'd love to talk to him as well. So there's guys out there. I don't know if I have a one definitive guy. Like, you've got your Ernie. He's got his Thurman. But that's my little list, my little short list. Neil, you a little surprised to hear from Thurman right now, just checking in?
Yeah, just casually dropping in on the show and delivering some really quality info. I mean, I'm not a Bills fan, so I didn't really watch any of Thurman's like post-game press conferences or any interviews like that, but the dude can bring it.
Yeah. I mean, Tony is like out of breath. He didn't even talk to the guy.
That was
great. That was very cool. I don't want to sound like a fanboy or anything like that, but let's just be honest. I don't want to be phony about it. That was awesome that we just got to talk to Thurman Thomas right there. That's one of the beauties of this show is that we get to talk to these guys, and it's like a little nugget. And this guy, like, what we're when you think like Thurman Thomas is going to call in, normally you're like, oh, we'll just talk about his career and the Super Bowls and this and that. But right off the bat, he drops the information that this guy was in the war room, and that gives you a whole other thing because he's able to add not only what it's like to be in the war room, but also to give the appreciation of this guy who is a Hall of Fame running back who probably never appreciated what went behind the scenes and all this, and they're just like, we need to get a safety or whatever it is, you know what I mean, as a player. So to see both sides of it, there's not many guys that could add that perspective on earth, let alone from Thurman Thomas.
To me, the funny part is, here's Tony D to my left, over the moon with excitement, and the first thing I thought of, honestly, when we realized that's Thurman Thomas calling in, one of the greatest running backs of all time, my first thought was to ask him about Sammy Watkins. That's what a college football
nerd
is. Because I'm like, I couldn't believe all they gave away to get up to the and I'm going, I got to ask Thurman.
But he sold
that.
Me. And I'm like, oh, that's a great job. He sold me. And the fact that he was just like talking with Jim Kelly earlier today, he's at
no
his house, and then just chimes in. Right, it's just
then he calls us to shoot the bull, you know. Just
that's it.
Calls in, no problem.
Up. You notice I did keep my Jets fan card in my back pocket. I was not dropping that on.
No, absolutely not.
No way. I would just whatever you need, brother. I was rounding the wagons, circling the wagons.
We have the same reaction when we interview these cool guys like this. We all just sit here and just, like, are euphoric about it.
Yeah, I know.
You know, even if you don't root for the team, we're just like...
The look on your face, because I wasn't in the studio when this was all going down. I come downstairs, and all of a sudden, Thurman Thomas is on the air.
The screen over here was blowing up.
With people, and you just didn't go to any of them.
I didn't know if it was Thurman Thomas, the Family Feud lady. I didn't know if it was Matt from Norwalk, Nick from Norwalk, Ed Salas. I mean, he could have been calling in to break down the Broncos a little bit. I didn't know.
Yeah, no, that's Johnny Descalla. Eddie Salas does break down the Broncos. Johnny Descalla breaks down the Lions. We got a lot of guys. Could be Paul from Brantford just breaking down
You know what I want to know, though?
College hoops.
Who's Neil's Ernie Banks?
Yeah, Neil.
Talk to Harry Carson.
I know. Like, I am curious about that because I know you're like a diehard Met fan and a diehard Giants fan, although I feel like you're more Giants. Like, I'm a more Mets than Jets and Nets. I feel like maybe the Giants are your number one team, Neil. Maybe I'm wrong. Am I right about that? And who's your guy?
It's got to be number 11, Phil Sims.
Yeah.
I remember being in college and watching VHS tapes of his games from the 80s. I mean, it's pathetic how much of a fanboy I am of this guy. And to hear him broadcast every Sunday is just like, it's amazing.
Yeah, that would be cool. I would love to talk to Phil Sims, actually. I mean, a guy that wants to go toe-to-toe with Bill Parcells, and like, you know, everybody knows those intimidating people, whether it's your boss or whoever you work for, that like very few people have the balls to go after. And Phil Sims is a guy who stood up to Bill Parcells and would just scream at him. That just not only takes like moxie, but just takes an utter amount of just like confidence in yourself to be telling Bill Parcells, no, you don't tell me what to do. I'm Phil freaking Sims.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Belichick crap from him.
Yeah.
But not Phil Sims.
I'm fairly sure that Phil would get nose to nose with LT sometimes as well. So, I mean, you know, he has that, like, no, maybe it's just because he's from the South and he's from Kentucky and he doesn't know any better, but I appreciate his moxie. And, you know, I didn't realize, like, how old he was towards the end of his career, but, I mean, the fact that he was able to still be productive at such an age, and to take the kind of licking that he did over his career and still keep it together enough to lead him to a playoff charge. I mean, you know, the moments that he's had and the charisma and fire and intensity, and I mean, he captured the city. And I can't tell you how many pictures I drew of this kid. Of this guy as a kid. I mean, it's just disgusting.
I mean, do you think he's the toughest blonde guy ever to live the, I mean, other than maybe the guy from Karate Kid, from Cobra Kai? Like, it's got to be the two of them head-to-head, right? Who else, what other blonde is going to be tougher than this guy?
I mean, you got Ivan Drago, you got the Karate Kid, and then you got Phil Sims, I think, pretty much.
Yeah, but Ivan was phony tough. He was a bully. That guy, when it came down to it, yeah.
Steroids.
Yeah, right, and his wife is weird-looking, whatever. So, a girlfriend was in that movie. I'm talking about Cobra Kai. That guy was tough, although he got hit in the nose and he backed down a little bit. Maybe Phil Sims is the toughest blonde ever to walk the earth.
Ray.
Just gross.
Yeah, buddy.
I'm tired of
watching. Pam Anderson has gone through a lot of troubles and turmoil. She was barbed wire, so maybe you can put her below Phil Sims.
Yeah, she's just a tick below Phil Sims. And as euphoric as we are here in the studio, I look over my left shoulder, and last time I looked up, the Nets were up by like 8. Ray Allen just pops a little jump shot. Now the Heat are up 93-91. I don't even know why I got sucked back in. I was fully accepting the fact that they were going to lose tonight. And now you see them sort of lead, and now it's 32 seconds left. They're down 2. I mean, it's time for the truth, right?
How does that make you feel, honestly, that it's a UConn guy that hits that shot against your favorite team? Does that affect you in any way?
You know,
like, if it was Paul Pierce against my favorite team, I would find some happiness in it.
But you know what? I don't. What's so weird about Ray Allen is he is, like, to me, still the patriarch of UConn basketball. You know, we had Scotty Burrell on. You've got the Daniel Marshalls. You got the rest. You got these guys who came before Ray Allen. But Ray Allen was the guy that put UConn where they were, right? And you would think that, like, he could do no wrong in my mind. But and I loved his big shot last year. I had this, like, euphoria. I'm miserable that he hit that shot. I don't have that. But I'm not a college guy like you are.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I don't think we have the same. And I love UConn basketball, but not to that extent.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to wear that right there. My first reaction was to punch you in the face because you were in the way of me and the TV screen. Very angry. All right, Tone, can we take a quick break? We got a great guest coming in 9:30. We're just going to tease a little bit. Probably the internet sensation of last week is going to be calling in. So check us out. We got about 30 minutes left. If you want to call in the last part of the show, 347-637-2306. We'll be right back.
Is anyone out there? This is the Nathaniel County Sheriff's Office. Is anyone out there? We were surrounded by the dead. They were in rioters, we were told. We have survivors here. Civilians, women, children. Is anyone out there?
Follow the story in the Ragnarok Rising Saga by D.A. Roberts, available on Amazon, Smashwords, Barnes & Noble, and BooksAMillion.com. Visit RagnarokRising.Weebly.com.
All right, we're back. Tri-State Sports Guys. Check us out, as always, every Wednesday night, TriStateSportsGuys.com. You know, we just got done talking to Thurman Thomas, one of the all-time greats. Got a great show going on. But we got a guest now. We talk about topical. I mean, one of the, you know, really the sensation around the Internet for the past week. And I feel like I have a bond with this woman because we were in the same spot. I was the closer on Family Feud. And so we're going out to the Tucci Lumber Hotline now, calling in Miss Anna Sass. Anna, are you with us?
I am here. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you? I mean, let me ask you this, my first question. So when did you film the show? Obviously, when we did it, we filmed it in June, didn't air till September, and then they put this, like, big gag order, you better not tell your family, you can't tell your wife, you can't tell this. And so when did you film the show? And second question is, did you keep the whole thing a secret? Be honest. Now you've got your money. Did you keep it a secret?
Well, we filmed last July, end of July of 2013. And when we came back, we did tell people, but that was just because, to be completely honest, we did not win that much money, so we figured, well, if they take it away, what the heck, we don't really care. We had a great time. So we definitely came back and told people, not realizing, you know, how big of a deal it really was until now.
Well, yeah, that's my next question is, so you knew it was going to air. Did you have, like, a family get-together? Did you guys all watch it together? I mean, I know we had, like, you know, my cousins over, aunts, uncles, everybody to watch it because they genuinely, even my wife didn't know how we did. So was there a viewing party? How did you do it?
We had a couple viewing parties. We watched the first three, one at each person's house. So everybody kind of got to host, whether it was, you know, my father-in-law or sister-in-law. And then obviously us. And then when the last two aired, unfortunately, we all weren't together to watch it. But we watched it and then talked on the phone and texted each other back and forth, laughing hysterically at everything that was happening.
Yeah, exactly. That's so did you know that it was going to become the sensation? I mean, basically, you know the show. I mean, it's not a show where, like, the smartest people win. It's kind of a lucky show no matter what. They're trying to... Basically, yeah, it is. And the producer told us that because in our next game, we were up like 250 to nothing. We lost our next game. It goes right around and it was done. So they're looking for YouTube moments like this, you know, the guy who gives the crazy answer or whatever. So did you know, did you have an inkling that this was going to take off or no? I mean, I wouldn't have thought it would have.
No, we had absolutely no idea. I mean, we gave so many horrible answers on our first three rounds that we thought, oh, Those are going to be the ones that, you know, get picked up on YouTube and people are going to watch them. And some of them they did, but for whatever reason, I still have no idea why my all zeros went viral. Still have no clue. Wish I would have known because then I could have capitalized on something, but that's okay.
Right. Exactly. You could have promoted it.
I could have promoted it, but I have no idea. So that's okay. Maybe they'll bring me back.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's what we all thought. We're going to get brought back. I don't think that really happens on real life. So walk us through that because I had the same exact problem as you were. I went second. I gave three answers and heard the and that all of a sudden your internal clock starts speeding up. You could be as calm as a cucumber out there. You start hearing that little buzzer and you're like, I just gave a good answer. What the hell are we doing? I mean, so walk us through that. I mean, I've been in your shoes, but everybody thinks like, oh, you know, you gave three. You didn't get a zero. If you had gone first, you would have had three, you know, number one answers. So did you feel pressure mounting and that internal clock in your head?
Oh, of course. I mean, when I got the first buzzer, it just about killed me. And then obviously I came back with the third answer and said pass because my brain was just so rattled. I didn't even know where the heck I was. And then, of course, with my fourth one, I got buzzed again. And then fifth one, I got buzzed. And I just thought, man, I don't feel like I gave bad answers. They just weren't, you know, the second best answer. And, of course, my father-in-law had to be super smart and give all the number one answers. So, you know, in hindsight, we should have had him could do cleanup and let me go first. But, that, you know, everything's a coulda, woulda, shoulda. So,
that's great. Yeah, well, that would have been worse. Look,
as a good look, I'm married, so I know, like, my father-in-law, you took the bullet for the team, because it would have been way worse if it's your father-in-law being the guy who's dropping the hammer. You would have never heard the end of it. So you're the guy, you're the woman that took the bullet there. So you gotta wear that as a badge of honor.
Oh, I should get some kind of a medal or something.
So that's an extra Christmas present this year. You're going to get under your tree and you're going to say, you know what, I took a bullet for the team here and made us famous. one of the things I took away from, so, you know, we're up here in Connecticut. My parents live down in Florida. They came up from Florida to Atlanta to watch the show, and they took away how funny Steve Harvey is. You know, he does all the things in between that people on the watching at home don't see. It's great. And the look on his face, I mean, you could tell it was genuine, like he felt awful. And that's not like stage or anything. You could see that. I mean, did he say anything to you afterwards? Did he come up and say, like, you know, you gave some good answers? What was Steve Harvey's reaction immediately, you know, when the cameras went off? Did he give you anything to you?
You know, to be completely honest, I have no idea. I just remember him giving me the biggest hug I have ever gotten in my entire life and telling me that it would be okay. I know he said a whole bunch of other stuff, but in that moment, that hug was the best thing that I could have ever had in my entire life. He is just the most genuine guy ever. And the fact that he is so engaging with not only the contestants but the audience, it just shows what a cool guy he really is deep down. I just think he's an awesome guy. And, you know, he really genuinely cares about everybody on the show, which I don't know if that's normal or not normal, but that just seemed really, really neat to me. So I love him.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat, and I'm not a guy. I mean, I liked him. I've seen, like, you know, Kings of Comedy, and I thought it was funny, but I didn't know much about him. And then I had so much appreciation from him, seeing him live and how funny he is off the cuff. And he also has his radio show. He does a TV show. He's the busiest guy in the world. But when we hit our $20,000 thing, when the cameras went off, he came running over to me. So it's not on camera or anything. Gave me a hug and was like, I knew it was the number one answer. I knew it was the number one answer. He's like showing me the card. He's like, I couldn't show it to you. Like, he was so genuinely excited. So I almost want to get people, like, anybody that ever has a bad word to say about Steve Harvey, I feel like he's my brother. I'm like, you can't say a word about that guy. That guy's salt to the earth. Saw it firsthand.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, he is just such a cool guy. I don't think people really know who he is deep down. And once you get that insight as to who he is as a person, he's just a real deal. Just a great guy. Love him.
Absolutely. So, you know, you went through the process. You obviously, it's an exciting time. And you're from out west somewhere, right?
Yeah, we're from, well, the whole family is from Stockton, California, which is literally about 30 minutes from the capital, Sacramento. But my husband and I actually live in Lodi, which is a really small little wine country town, great place. But yeah, we're all from the West Coast. Absolutely love it out here. And but had a great time in Georgia. Oh my gosh, what a neat state! And Atlanta is such a cool town. Had no idea.
Yeah, it was one of the weirdest big cities I've ever been to, because it was like, you know, we're in the Northeast. Everything is close, you know, New York City or Boston or whatever. Everything's close, and you walk everywhere. Where Boston, you know, I mean, in Atlanta, you're in the hotel, and we're like, let's go walk somewhere, and you're like, no, you got to go downtown. There's like, it's so spread out. It's a lot different than what we see up here. But I took away the same thing. So your family goes on that trip, and you know, it's fantastic. Obviously, you get to go away with your family. It's a memory, you know, you're going to take for a lifetime, and you know, you win some games and all that. But like, I mean, are you guys now? Because immediately on our flight home, we're like, what is the next game show? Can we go on? Should we go on Amazing Race? Should we do this? Were you guys doing the same thing? Like, we got to get, and when our 12 months is up, we're getting back on Family Feud, or we're going to go find something else. Are you guys having those talks? You guys going to be back on a reality show or something?
You know, not yet. My husband and my sister-in-law were actually on Minute to Win It about 4 years ago, so they did that. And then my sister-in-law was on Price is Right, oh, my gosh, was it 10 years ago? So she is the game show queen. That's her thing. So they're looking into other game shows. I don't know. They're thinking about doing a whole brother-sister combo, which is great. Gives the rest of the family a little break until the next second round comes up. So, but we'll see. Who knows what we're going to end up doing. It'll probably be something ridiculous. Maybe we'll all do Amazing Race, and we could go with you. That'd be fun.
That would be great. We'd bring Connecticut and California together, and we'd have this bond. I think it'd be good. But you know what? When I get to competition, I'm very cutthroat, though, and there's no friends in these competitions. So we could have some fun out here, get on the show, and it'd be a whole different ballgame.
The plane ride will be nice, but then once we get there, it's all over.
That's right. It's all going to get now, Anna, but when we get down to the brass tacks, it's going to be a whole different ballgame. Well, you know what? I really appreciate your good sport about all this. I do feel like we have a bond, and I did. I mean, I had somebody in my office show it to me because, you know how it is. When you're on the show, everybody that you know knows you're on it. Like, hey, did you see this? All I did was like, you have no idea what it's like to be up there, bro. You have no idea what it's like to be up there. Because it's tough, and you hear that, and it's a whole, it changes your life. So I was on Team Man this whole time, and I really appreciate you coming on and taking a few minutes to tell your story and all that. And I'm glad that you feel the same way about Steve Harvey as I do.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you so much for having me. I definitely appreciate doing this.
All right. I want to see you on The Amazing Race. We'll be pulling for you, all right?
All right. Sounds good.
Thank you very much. That's Anna Sass. We'll post up the video up there. But if you see it, I mean, you see the headline of it, like, oh, she, girl gets a 0 points, you know, and they only need 18 or whatever. But if you watch it, I mean, the girl gets 3 number one answers, Danny. I mean, you know, and we're in a business of trying to criticize people, but I can't criticize this woman. And she's a sweetheart.
No, I think it's every game show I watch, there's that part of me that goes, if I was on it, you make fun of somebody like Jeopardy, like, how do you not know Capital Connecticut, you know?
Yeah.
But then you're like, man, when those lights are on and everything's going on, and you see somebody on Wheel of Fortune screw up, you're like, how on earth did you screw that up? There's pressure. You know that pressure. You've been on there. But for guys like me to sit here and poke fun.
Coffee's for closers, bro. Some people can close. You know what I mean? You get the 20 G's, it's 20 G's. All right. What, did Nets just lose?
Yeah.
They did.
Like, terribly.
LeBron James literally, I was just telling your pops, he reaches in, slaps Paul Pierce on the hand, ball goes out of bounds, and then they're worried about who the ball went off of, which it went off Miami. Where's the foul call? It's supposed to be going to line there in the double bonus. But
no,
LeBron gets away with everything.
Oh, yeah.
So that's just the way it goes.
Well, you're not gonna. I mean, which is dumb because you'd want to extend this series. It'd be great, but whatever. That's just what happens.
I don't like seeing people hit Paul Pierce.
So let me just ask you just to put a bow on the Nets season.
Yeah.
This is a disappointing season?
Yeah, it has to be.
I think it is, too. It feels weird to say it. Like, look, they didn't. Nobody in the world, even after their trade, said they were better than the Heat. But you go and you beat them 4 times in the regular season to go out in 5 games like this, especially the way Game 4 ended. Like, you had Game 4. You had a very good chance. And they go in these runs. They did it last year, and I thought that the Pierce-Garnett combo would alleviate these runs where all of a sudden they have this lead and it goes away. And that was like their bugaboo last year. And it was their same thing this year. They seemed to kind of alleviate it when the calendar flipped. And then it kind of came back a little bit late in the season. And you saw it in the Toronto series and you saw it in this series. It's like, it's amazing. It doesn't matter. The players could change, but
no.
It's amazing. How could you go on these, like, you know, 10-0 droughts and you're like, what are you doing?
It's more frustrating because you just alluded to it. You're in the series.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they lose 4-1, but you had a chance.
You're going to look at this and say they lost in 5 games.
Yeah, you didn't get your doors blown in.
Not at all.
You had a chance. If you lost 4 straight games by a combined 50 points, you'd go, you know what, dude? We just weren't good enough. But the fact that you should have won Game 4,
you
had some horrible mistakes down the stretch. The fact that you lose this game that you're in, that makes it more frustrating as a fan when my team's in a game that they eventually lose.
It's worse.
It's more upsetting than when they just get blown out because it's like, we were right there, and you just don't do it. So, yeah, it has to be a failure. I mean, for all the reasons you gave up, all the stuff you did to Boston to make the trade, do all the things you did, and to fall short like the way they did, having a chance, because that makes it look like the trade maybe was good.
Yeah.
We were there, and for whatever reason, we couldn't
do it. Yeah, but let me ask you one more. I know I said something about it, but let me ask you one more question. This is about the Heat. Is there ever going to be a chance when Eric Spoelstra gets any credit? I mean,
no.
When you start winning these, like, close games – we talk about this big three. Can we just – I mean, I know Chris Bosh hit that big three-pointer, you know, a couple games ago, and you're like, oh, you know, it's a big shot. But Chris Bosh is not a big three of anything.
No, he's
not in Miami. Let's be honest.
I said it a while ago. I said if their buddy was Amari Stoudemire, so that's who they call to unite the three of them, they probably have the same results. I mean, you know, you could make the argument that Amari could have played less minutes, stayed healthier. They don't even need Chris Bosh.
No,
I mean, it's
just
stunning to me. And the reason I don't give the Heat credit, period, is because he's really the only great player, LeBron, in his prime who had to get together with other guys and go to someone else's team, essentially, because it was Wade's team.
Yeah.
He went to Wade's team, even though he's a million times better.
But we could say it's a Wade-LeBron team, but just the fact that Bosh is in this mix.
No, it's LeBron's team.
I mean,
I don't even count
Bosh
Wade.
Bosh is no more than a Joe Johnson. He's a,
no.
You know, let's just call it what it is. I mean, so, but you got to give, when you see a team like the Heat winning all these close games and winning down the stretch where they're down in the fourth quarter, I know they have LeBron, and I know he's the best player in the world, but Spoelstra, I think, doesn't get credit for what he does. I mean, this guy's going to, I mean, he's on.
It's hard to, though.
It is hard to give him credit, but it's like, you say that until you are rooting for a team that's got talent that doesn't have a coach that can put it together.
See, it's interesting to me because I can say on one hand that LeBron's the best player in the league. What I find amazing is people think there's this enormous gap, and I'm not saying that Durant's better than him, but people talk about it as though it's not even close, as though Durant's this excellent player and LeBron's in this other universe. But the thing about it is, if and when Durant ever wins a championship, even if it's only one in his career, to me, I'm not saying it's a fact, just to me, it's infinitely more valuable than if LeBron wins six, because he's going to stay in OKC, win there, just like Isaiah did, just like Jordan did.
Yeah, I mean, to build
like
up
Gretzler
that
did.
Franchise when I they mean, got him, it's a lot different.
That's why
it would have been
no
when LeBron
credit.
Would have been, but I don't get, I think they say give no credit.
No. I just look at it like it's not the same when people compare him to the players of yesteryear, which they do in every sport, but.
But you, I just
he left. Imagine if he played 20 years in Cleveland and won one title for that city. To me, it lifts him to a whole other level, and I wouldn't dislike him like I do. It's the way he did everything. So Spoelstra, he's not going to get credit. Does he deserve some? Yeah.
He deserves some credit.
He deserves some. But he's not going to get it.
Different
he's not going to get it.
The Bronx different debate for a different time. We'll have a couple more weeks.
How many championships do you think you'd have if you coached this team the last 2 years? How about a 500-assistant coach?
Well, maybe.
I'll put in some plays.
Because
and we just get out of the way.
Just get out of the way and go make plays.
That's all it is.
I like it. All right, Neil, you got a lot of time here. You got about 15 minutes. Well, can you give us some good due to you series? I mean, this has been a great show. I don't think there's any way around it. I thought every guest we've had has been great. Thurman Thomas, Anna Sass, Mark Schmidt. Give us a good something to close the door on the whole thing.
Well, I mean, this is not a dude, are you serious? I don't know if you guys mentioned this. Maybe you did, and you can stop me in my tracks, but Steve Kerr signed with Golden State. Did you cover that?
Whoa. No, we did not. I'm a busy guy here with my two little kids. I did not. I'm telling you, I had this feeling when it didn't happen right away, I had this feeling he wasn't going to New York. And to me, I thought that, like, the only reason that he would ever pick New York over Golden State is if he just had this insane loyalty to Phil Jackson where he felt like this guy stuck his neck out for me. I also wonder if he would have been such a hot commodity had Phil Jackson not made this big push for him. Did Phil Jackson make Steve Kerr? I mean, this guy's been sitting up in the broadcasting booth for a few years, doesn't have any head coaching experience. Now all of a sudden this year he becomes this hot commodity. I think that Phil Jackson made him. I mean, it's a great business decision by Steve Kerr to, like, let you go be my promoter. This guy comes here, I'm going to bring in Steve Curry. He's the smartest guy I know. He knows my offense, knows this and that. And then say, well, that's great. Thanks for all the promotion there, Phil. I'm going to go to a team that actually has some players that can win.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a Steve Kerr fan for a multitude of reasons, but putting that aside, I'm just...
He's not the toughest blonde in your book?
I'm not a fan of his broadcasting. I'm not a fan of his voice. I'm not a fan of the fact that he was hired as the GM in Phoenix a few years ago, and no one even talks about the fact that how short his stay was there because he had no idea what the hell he was doing. He had no idea.
Yeah, I always hate this idea, like, this guy's going to be a great GM.
Yeah, he was essentially B.J. Armstrong or John Paxson. That's the kind of player he was, you know, when he won in Chicago and San Antonio or whatever.
He couldn't sniff Robert Horry's jockstrap.
No, and then they lead into those TNT broadcasts with here with Hall of Famer Reggie Miller and five-time NBA champion Steve Kerr, as though you wouldn't have those rings if you were on the team he was on. So I don't know where this
You give
came
me open
from.
Looks in the corner, Danny. I'll knock him down right now.
Answer me that.
Tony will tell you.
How does Patrick Ewing not even get an interview? How does Kareem Abdul-Jabbar not get an interview at UCLA last year before they hired Steve Alford? Yet Steve Kerr, who's never coached a day in his life,
amazing.
Is just kind
That's
of brilliant.
Why
I
asked Scotty Burrell that question last week, and he's like, oh, no, he's the smartest guy. But it amazes me that this guy came out of nowhere. We have talked about Patrick Ewing. Not only was this guy a great player, which apparently is some sort of tick on your resume, which I don't understand how one correlates to the other, but whether you're going to be a good coach or not. I actually think bad players are normally better coaches in most sports. But Not only did he do that, he's done the grunt work. He's been an assistant coach for how long?
Yeah.
He, like, banged around, like, put in his time to go learn the things.
Herb Williams has been on the Knicks bench since we were 5 years old.
Oh, yeah, and then they're like, we fired a coach, we'll let Herb come in and head coach for a while. He's not a disaster. And then they're like, all right, Herb, go back down and whatever. You know, we'll call you back up when you're needed.
I'd be stunned. We'll move on to the next topic, but I'd be stunned if this isn't a discernible step back from Mark Jackson, who I think knows the game. What he did was, he didn't let Jerry West into a practice, which I guess you can't do that. I mean, I get that, and then I guess he had some issues with some different people in the front office, but he seemed to have a grip on that Warriors team. Steph Curry is their best player by leaps and bounds, and he loved them.
Yeah.
So I don't know why you do this unless maybe Curry's signing off on it. Like, I like Curry because he's a former shooter, so he'll get me spots. I don't know.
Yeah, right. What did he do to
get off
the hook? He just happened to be playing with Michael Jordan and the rest. But the last thing I'm going to say is I agree with you. Like, this idea that Steve Kerr somehow in like a neutral playing field is going to be a better coach than Mark Jackson is just insanity to me. And I always hate the idea of they got to have a coaching change. There's just the idea. Do you not like what he's doing? Well, no, but they got to be winning. And this guy's job is in jeopardy.
Well, he picked off Jerry West.
It's like what they did with – remember like Tom Coughlin was an awful coach in 2006 and they win a Super Bowl. That was like his last chance. Yeah. He didn't get to be a better coach. I don't think. And then it was like, well, he's in trouble again. And then he goes and wins. He was always a good coach.
Yeah.
You get a guy that's a good coach, he's a good coach. There's no way Steve Kerr. And maybe I'm wrong. But we've never seen him.
No,
it would be shocking if this first-year head coach, never coached at any level, is now all of a sudden going to be a better coach than Mark Jackson was.
I think the real winners here are the Knicks. Point, period.
Yeah.
I really do. I think they're the winners
here. A real coach.
I think they're the winners here if they hire Herb Williams because he's been there. He knows it. He was a good player in his day. But whatever they do, I think they win. If they get a guy with any experience, they probably win.
Yeah. And
maybe
Knicks fans are out there angry right now, and they don't even know why they're angry.
No,
they're angry because Phil Jackson wanted him, and they just assume Phil Jackson must know something. There's no way anybody's like, I like Steve Kerr's coaching style. I like his philosophy because nobody knows what it is. He's a talking head. He's one half a step ahead of what we're doing. He hasn't talked to Thurman Thomas.
Maybe Jackson didn't really want him. Do you ever think about that? Because they're not going to lose a bidding war to the Golden State Warriors.
You would not think.
No, you're not going to. Jim Dolan?
There.
You're just not going to lose that.
Oh, yeah, it can't be a money thing.
So maybe Jackson's got some plan here. I don't know what it is. He knows a lot more about
that. Zen...
He's the Zen master. He's got to know a lot more about a lot of things than I do. So maybe he's got a plan. Maybe he was putting Kerr out there to do something. Maybe we'll find out in a couple of weeks or something. I don't know. But the Knicks win, I think.
What's odd, the most odd more than this is that a due-to-you-serious topic garnered a real discussion.
That's how good Neil is.
The next one's going to bring us back into the gutter, I'm
sure,
Neil.
It's going to be about bacon-flavored beer.
This is going to be about some sort of alcoholic beverage, some sort of heart attack special, or a naked woman. Neil, what do you got?
Well, you guys pretty much nailed it. Carlos Gomez. Carlos Gomez ate the Wendy's combo number 7 45 days in a row when he first came to America.
What? Is that the Asiago
chicken? If it's the Asiago, I love him.
If it's the Asiago chicken ranch combo, then he's my favorite player. I've defended him. Now he will be my favorite. I had to look up what the number 7 is. Maybe Tony can find that out. But at a number 7 for 45 straight days from Wendy's, too.
Yeah.
You figure you come to America, you think Golden Arches. He's like, no, I like the redhead thing. They don't...
Where's he from,
I want to say he's from Puerto Rico, but
Where's
I might be wrong.
That's
my only bank
Wendy's
to me.
Down there.
Just assume.
Right? They got
Wendy's
in Puerto Rico. I mean, they might have it in the Dominican or someplace like that, but they got to have them down there. It's pretty Americanized, so I don't know. But maybe that's like the Wade Boggs deal. You used to eat the fried chicken sandwich
what
or whatever.
What makes me more angry? What would happen to you if you ate Wendy's 45 days in a row?
My bathroom would very much dislike me.
It would just destroy me.
It would not be good.
You'd need a new co-host.
Yeah.
I'd be,
Plus, I get the nuggets, too, for 99 cents more.
Well, they're there.
Because I'm tough like that.
I think their chili is kind of banging. I get a chili for 99 cents, and I just pour my french fries right in there.
And then do you sit in the bathroom and eat it? Because the fries would have to eat it.
Then I save up my PTO time and take a day off, and I do the whole thing,
Yeah, God bless them. What else you got, Neil?
Jimmy Haslam. Who is a Cleveland Browns executive. I don't know if he's the GM or what, but he said that a homeless person told him to draft Johnny Manziel.
Might be Ernest Biner.
Come on, dude.
They do not like him in that town. He's the owner of the Cleveland Browns, and I actually heard this. That is stunning to me. Really? That? Come on. He's already said he's not going to be the starter over Brian Hoyer, which is almost impossible.
Yeah.
I think I'm standing next to three, maybe four guys with your pops here, maybe four guys right now that are better quarterbacks than Brian Hoyer. So.
And Brian Hoyer's like, bring it on.
Yeah,
bring
he's not going to start. He's got homeless guys talking to him. He owns the Browns. This guy seems suspect in a lot of ways. I'm being honest.
Yeah, the whole thing sounds suspect, but my the thing about it, the whole thing is, I actually love the way the Browns played the first round.
Because I've been saying that before.
Everybody was assuming they were going to take Manziel. Now, we could have differing opinions on what kind of quarterback he is, but the experts and the talking heads all thought they were going to get him. Not only did they get him, they went out and got him and got a first-round pick next year from a team that's – I mean, whether you think the Bills are going to be great or bad or whatever, it's going to be a top 18 pick. You know, it's going to be a good first-round pick. And they got all that and got Manziel. So you could look at it and say nobody, none of these Mel Kuypers of the world and these idiots out there predicted that. So where are you on that one?
You've got, I was saying it earlier, you've got Justin Gilbert, who graded out as the number one corner in the draft, you know, considerably above Darqueze Dennard. Then a couple days
later. Everybody loved Dennard, though. What was up with that? Like, everybody I talked to.
Gilbert's bigger. Gilbert's a little bit fat. He ran like a 4.3.
But like, what was the Dennard like? Did he put up? No, like, I don't know stats wise. Like,
they never threw at him at Michigan State. They almost never threw to his side of the field. And Gilbert played in a pass happy league in the Big 12 and shut down.
Yeah, I mean, I think at Michigan State you could probably be like, well, if we're gonna throw, we just throw to this.
So I think what they did when you look at drafting Gilbert, getting Manziel later in the first round, and then signing Joe Hayden to an extension a couple days later, you're talking about a pass happy league. That they should have two very, very good corners now.
Yeah.
And if Manziel does anything, and they can get him any kind of offense and do some things, that's a team where, you know, we talk about on the show a lot, pass rush and pass coverage now is the order of the day in that league, and the Browns killed it. I think them and the Rams, when you look at what the Rams did signing, drafting Robinson and Aaron Donald to an already good defensive front and solidifying the line around Bradford, those two teams killed it in the first round. Absolutely out of the park. So, yeah, I mean, Haslam's talking a lot of stuff, but I think his franchise
He sounds like an idiot, but you look at what they've done, and it's pretty good. All right, well, Carlos Gomez, by the way, from the Dominican Republic, so you were right. Neil, what else you got, brother?
Hockey fans can now eat popsicles made out of the actual ice their favorite players skated on. Dan Santarella, what flavor popsicle would you eat?
From my favorite player of all time, is that what you're saying?
Well, it could be your favorite player. It could be a player that you think would taste good.
Oh, God in heaven. That's just bad in a lot of ways. But I got to be honest, my favorite player since I was a kid was Paul Coffey. So I remember watching him. I was too young.
A coffee-flavored popsicle.
I was going to say, that's almost too cheesy for you to even
I'm not even being funny. I didn't even think of the pun.
I mean, yeah.
But Paul Coffey was my favorite player, so if you want
to know. Wasn't a passion fruit that played winger for somewhere?
No.
No.
Maybe Yard Curry? Curry flavor?
Yeah, you
ice.
Go, Curry.
So I don't know. But yeah, Paul Coffey was my favorite, but I'm not eating. Are you eating ice that dudes are skating on?
Absolutely.
Get the hell out of here.
First of all, the amount of blood that drops on the ice in a hockey game.
Almost like tennis.
And the amount of tail that these guys get. Yeah. I'm not messing with the blood of a hockey guy.
No.
Because no athlete pulls tail like a hockey guy. You know that.
No, I've always read things along those lines.
Well, yeah, every girl, for whatever reason, no girl knows anything about hockey, but they would date a hockey guy right now.
I think it's, you know what it is? I think it's women see the power of the skating motion and figure these guys just go.
Because it's elegant and aggressive. Like, it's both of those two
and
things
tough,
they like.
And none of them have
because all they
feet.
Want is a tough guy who will, like, read poetry, and you're like, well, this guy can ice skate.
Yeah.
But he also could beat up any aggressor.
Right.
So that's a bonus.
And he carries a stick around with him.
He carries a stick.
Plays with separated shoulders.
So I'll eat his ice.
I'll eat the ice.
There you go. What else you got, Neil?
Last one. It's a two-parter, and it's a baseball-related days. Would you rather lose a no-hitter, so lose a game, get no hit, lose 27-0, and not get one hit, or would you rather blow a 17-1 lead? Both of those things happened this past week.
I would probably rather – so the options are getting no hit with 27 Ks or blowing a 17-1 lead. I would rather do the 27, you know, strikeout.
No, you
no
lost
hit.
27-0 you lost. The score was 27-0. You got no hit, or would you rather blow a 17-1 loss at least?
Oh, I'd still – nothing would be worse than blowing a 17-1 loss.
No.
There's not anything. There's no – blowing a 17-1 lead
would be the most, because you've been in those, when you blow a 5-run lead and it just like eats you up inside. You're like, as it's going, it's happening in front of you. You're seeing like the death of a, you know, and you're just like, this is awful.
Remember George Allen with the Redskins years ago? He had the quote that he was the coach, said that every time you lose, a little part of you dies. That's how I feel. So
I'd rather
not
lose.
Blow that lead.
Yeah, I'd rather, 27-0, we got blown out.
Yeah.
You have a lead and you blow it, not even close. All right, well, thank you guys for listening. Thank you to Thurman Thomas, ooh, Anna Sass, Coach Mark Smith. Great show tonight. Thank you, Neil, for calling in, and good luck to you on Monday night. TriStateSportsGuys.com. Go see Neil, the Gotham Comedy Club, Monday night. TriStateSportsGuys.com, Facebook.com/TriStateSportsGuys. We'll see you next week.
Boom. We talked to Thurman Thomas.
That was awesome. I wish I would have been more.